they care and then one comes. Right, so we start. Very large team here. We're not overawed by your team, Momo and others. It's what you say that matters. And the numbers here imply that you're going to impress us with civic numeracy dominance. It's not going to happen. But let's see, all of those 3 million speak, right? So over to you, Momo, and your team. Those of you who don't know, the three committees here, and for others, are preoccupied with the issue of innocent financial flow and base erosion and profit shifting. It affects our three committees primarily. And since it's difficult to draw all seven committees together, we've agreed that at least once a quarter, where possible, we shall take this issue forward. In particular, today we're looking at the Panama Papers. We gather from the media that does affect South Africans. We'd like to know from the authorities here, all of them who are here, Reserve Bank, Financial Intelligence, International Treasury, and who else is here. Welcome, everybody. We would like to know what progress is there since the Panama Papers release. Of course, we know that what's in the public domain is very limited, that this stage it may be difficult for them to have done anything, but presumably they are working on it, and presumably more and more information will emerge if the media is released. So what are they planning to do if they haven't done enough yet? And secondly, what we want to know from Charles and others, since we last met you in November last year, was it, late last year, what has been progress in managing base erosion and profit shifting? My two colleagues and their committee members need to know that every time that Charles appears before us, we need to pursue the matter. Although recently, because all of our community occupies with project votes, and in our case, and presumably in the industry's case, endless legislation, it's not been so easy to do that. We have Tumasani Yanji here from the Parliamentary Budget Office, our expert from Parliament's side on this matter, and we know that the NCOP committees are also engaged with this issue. So this is going to be a major issue for the first term of Parliament and possibly beyond. Only yesterday, I think some of you might have heard of an SAFM, a figure of 23, what is it, billion? It was suggested it's disappearing. I don't know if that's correct, but more, yeah. I thought I heard that on the SAFM yesterday. But here we are, and I'll hand over to the industry and then we'll to say whatever they want to say. Thank you.
Yes, we hold in the tried and custom African custom as Africa Day meetings, colleagues. Now, I concur with Chairperson for Finance that indeed we have taken a decision to hold these meetings jointly, but in fact to be led and chaired by Finance, as this is the mandate directly of Finance, which we recognize and respect, while of course pushing at the gates to open to have the issue of transfer pricing effectively recognized. Thank you.
Now let me greet everyone. Just to say that funeral is always meet 9 o'clock. So other committee start at 10. So I don't want to drag the meeting for too long. I don't want to drag the meeting for too long so that we can come at the 9 o'clock time that we have believed. So I will allow Honorable Karim. My difficulty is that the competition age is so tough, can decide how they handle the elders. They will decide what to do. Probably for Kambamba and our peers, they have been competing equally with the change with next year. Okay, so I'll give to you,
Comrade Lozipo, come from the same tradition I come from. It's not a confused form of appearance. We started. Now, our committee meets twice the times the Minister's Committee meets. We have no T-Rex. We sit for a full 3 hours. We do not finish at 12:30. So it will be interesting to know how many hours we Minerals sit and how many hours we sit. Also, we might remind the Parliament as a whole, because we've been raising this issue. We've just passed a 48-page Financial Intelligence Center Bill. We have a 244-page 20-page bill. and a 72-page insurance bill, apart from the common tax bill that's looming and the public procurement bill that's coming. Apart from which, we have 4 tax bills in August, and it's just close to the tax bill. So there, and we delivered everything according to our deadline. So I think the issue of whether my class at 9 and 10 has got nothing to do with productivity and outcome, but this is something obviously we can debate. It's been raised before by Mr. Jenkins before, and we're not saying it's changed. We start promptly at 10 o'clock. We've never deviated for those interested. If I'm not here within 3 minutes, I hope I didn't listen. The whip, I hope Ulema is listening. If I'm not here within 3 minutes, then whip chair for somebody else is delegated to chair. So let's not confuse things. Now, can we end this dialogue? Please, Mr. Lazik, we're not going to win this one. Also, I think I should be very fair and clear. There's a hint by being an industry chair that we're in charge, not quite true. We overall coordinate, which means each of us. Windows is the biggest culprit, by the way. I think, Momo and I, Windows is one of the biggest culprits of illicit financial flow. And trade and industry is also another big culprit. Really, we are victims of these two committees. So really, we are all equally responsible. It's just that Parliament requires, because it falls on the portfolio of finance ultimately, that the finance committee takes responsibility for coordination. But in truth, we've been coordinating very well up till now, and were it not for our own respective legislative and other programs, we'd meet more often, and we'd like to do that. So let's hand over. The teams that are at Treasury, Ismail Momad, Sissel Momaniat, Ismail Momaniat, Sissel Morden, and Langan Pusa. We've got Vincent Dibande, Mr. Nishana, Josiah Lutz, Flock Simonson, and William M.P. Mary McMitchell, Nishwal Mevalal, Elizabeth Mazibugo, and Andre Mahere from staff, and the earlier two AFIC director, Mary Mitchell, you know. We also have trade and industry chief directors, and what can you introduce them?
Thank you so much, Chair Gerson. Nyondi Madula, and that is the chief director, ERPC, and also the Buwani Muki. In fact, it's Mubiki director. We have Invest Strategy Research Project, and Desmond Ramabulana, Director Commercial Law and Policy. Thank you very much, Chair.
Over then, Momo, can you tell us how you're going to manage this process?
Yes, Chair. Thank you very much, Chair.
The last question is a maximum of 45 minutes to an hour, so we can have this discussion. There are three committees here. Because we are so many, what the coaches feel, I think I'm up to 5 minutes. Yeah, we prefer to be to about 3 minutes, maximum of 5. Just pointed question. Starting with the year, I'm not going to make any decisions for your months now. All three of us are going to be focused. Over to you, 45 minutes, is that okay?
Well, mine will be shorter, but there's quite a few presentations.
All right, so make an hour maximum.
Yeah.
Good, fine, thank you. We're still over after 1 o'clock. I haven't had an eating, but 1 to 2 cheers will remain. Thank you.
Chair, thank you very much. And I think just to, you've already mentioned the delegation, and I think that just tends to show just how involved, in a sense, the Treasury-related entities are all involved with dealing with it. Chair, just to very quickly, and I'm just going to try and do a quick overview, and situate, I think, all the presentations. That, you know, the last time, we had a hearing in September 2015, if I remember. And the question is, you know, what's new since then? Obviously, we've heard on the issue of illicit flows, there's lots of reports that come out in newspapers. We've had, I don't know if members all have copies. So there have been the Panama Papers, and then there's lots of newspaper reports on illegal flows that, in fact, some MPs have raised, cash been taken in planes, neighboring countries, Dubai. But and again, our difficulty where we sit is, but is there any hard evidence? Because you see a lot in newspapers, and often people make those statements. It would really be helpful if people actually come to us and provide more info and say what's their source, because you can follow up. Make no mistake, all the authorities here, SARS reads newspapers, SAR reads newspapers, FIC reads newspapers, and all of those cases, in some way, one hopes that they take up. Okay. And again, the treasury has come out to reach specific cases they take now. You know, a lot of this info is confidential, certainly from the treasury, but there's some sharing between the entities. And I guess the objectives for us is firstly just to catch those responsible for any illicit flows out of South Africa, and as important, to make sure that our mechanisms, our preventative mechanisms, can actually be stepped up to the extent that we identify weaknesses so that you prevent illicit flows. And Chair, just to get to the point about who's the biggest transgressors, that's where it becomes a problem. You really don't know. Because firstly, and I'm using an old slide that I've used before in September, because just to remind members, by definition it's impossible to know the exact amount because these are illegal. And people don't report what they do illegal activities. All the numbers that are around are really estimates. And but obviously the banking panel, the global finance, the GFI for integrity, you've got UN agencies all coming up with numbers. And the honest fact is that we don't know if the real number, whatever it is higher than that, lower than that, significantly higher, significantly lower. I guess the question is, how do we get all the players to put out the data and get it verified in some way? To echo John Rumsfeld, who I don't often quote, but this is a good quote, getting to the knowns and the unknowns, we've got to be clear, what do we mean by illicit flows? Now, if we take the GFI in Washington, there is unrecorded money flows out of the country. It can take three forms, corrupt, criminal, or commercial. Okay, and I should add that their definition tends to be specific and the methodology is specific. So they look at the trade numbers and they look at our trade with country Y and what does country Y say about your trade with country X, and they try and compare. I think there are problems with those methodologies in terms of the numbers. We're not saying all these estimates are not useful. They are, but it doesn't give you an actual indicator. And we should also bear in mind that certainly for countries like South Africa, aside from illicit flows going out, there may well be illicit flows coming in from neighboring countries or other countries. Illicit money, by definition, is easily earned, transferred, or utilized, and it obviously violates laws or regulations in the origin country like South Africa. So I just say, what is a known unknown and unknown unknown? You know, we do know that there are illicit flows, but we don't know how much. There are also different types of illicit flows. It's not just one way, and that's why you've got the plethora of entities here. And you know what's legitimate and what's not legitimate. Even if you look at something like Panama, just because a name appears doesn't mean that it's illegitimate. It may well be that someone's got all the rules, taken their money out, and chosen to put it in a tax haven, okay, for whatever reason. And, you know, what's the best way to know? That's why we often have amnesties or the VDP, or it is better enforcement. It's probably better enforcement and giving people a chance to come right. Now, Chair, I'm not going to go through these questions, but this is the questions we started off with in September, you know. And really these are some of the answers that we need, because we need to figure out what problem are we trying to deal with when we talk this close. Is it to stop them into the future, or do we want to deal with those that have taken place in the past? And how do you get some justice, because clearly if people committed illegal acts, they shouldn't just be forgiven, they should be prosecuted, ideally. What are we doing about those? Similarly, just to remind members, it's also important what period you want to cover. Do we want to cover before 1994? When I'm sure with the birth of the new democracy, there were a lot of money that probably went out. Do you want to know what happened after 94? And bear in mind, we've had several amnesties in 2003, 2010, and the VDP from 2012 that's been in place. So there's some info. Now, Chair, just to be even more specific on illicit flows. As I said, not all goals are innocent. But let's look at, when I think we talk about illicit flows, we want to look at what laws have been transgressed. Now, it could be laws on drug laws, it could be human trafficking, counterfeiting, contraband. And for that, of course, you need to go to the prosecuting authorities directly. It could be corruption, the proceeds of bribery or theft. It could be fraud. A few days ago, you have seen that Standard Bank was targeted and 300 million rands was lost in Japan. That's an outflow. It could be commercial laws, obviously, and digital tax laws, tax avoidance. And there's a whole plethora of other acts. It could be related to licensing, it could be related to the Kimberley process, it could be related to the PFMA. So there's many authorities involved in dealing with it. But, you know, I think it's important we identify them and how do we get them to account. And what are the number of prosecutions? Because I think there are challenges there that we really don't have enough prosecutions. Often when cases are also reported, it's not always clear that there's a follow-up through prosecutions. And often the powers that most of the entities, certainly in the Treasury family, none of them have the power to prosecute. They can facilitate that by talking to the prosecuting authorities. So how best do you catch transgressors? Again, I've just outlined this, I won't deal with this slide. But I want to come here to a key point, the next slide. Okay. It's to the extent that we have agencies or state players doing something. It's a very important question to ask, are they coordinating their activities and are they sharing info? Because the tendency is for each to work in their own silo. And in fact, if you look at current laws here, and for those of us who are on the finance committees, you would have seen that you had the FIC amendment bill, you would have seen some of the informational challenges, and you see that there are lots of current laws which require confidentiality, and they even be specific about with whom they may share information. And often that is not really as broad as it should be. Okay? But there's also other considerations of privacy. So there also needs to be some sort of balancing. So yes, there is better coordination, I think certainly, but is it good enough? Certainly within the Treasury families, I think we do have a forum, we meet, but I do think more needs to be done. And you also need hard research. And as I said, the Treasury itself as a department, we don't have access to SARS information or FIC's information, the specific cases. They can share information amongst themselves, but and again, they won't be able to tell us specifically here about specific cases. But you hope, when there's a newspaper article, there's a follow-up. Okay. How much coordination and sharing of info between? And I mean, once this entity is reporting to different ministers, we can be certain it's tough enough to do within the Treasury family, but it becomes more difficult. So you get the criminal authorities, you get those reporting to the Minister of Finance. Do they coordinate? Those reporting to the Ministers of Trade and Industry, do they coordinate? And I will give a good example. For SARS, and for all of us, if you look at beneficial ownership, you need the CIPC to be quite involved as well. Are they involved? I don't have all the answers. We don't have all the time to ensure coordination. And often the info is still paper-based. It's not digitized. And Andre, what are you saying about Gibraltar?
Thanks for that one. I understand that the online laws are actually even in real time they update beneficial ownership of all companies, which is kind of opposite of each other's broad part, but that's what I understand.
So I'm just saying, country, whether it's your property deeds, whether it's whatever, if these are available online, it makes a huge difference to everybody. Okay. And are these things updated, like when they happen? Okay. Directives are changed, is a change. So, Chair, to get to the next slide, and again, I think most of you would know this, but, you know, the Treasury is involved with X1 approvals, deals with government bonds, so there's lots of outflows and inflows the Treasury itself is involved in. SARB itself is involved with, obviously, assessing the taxes, transfer pricing issues, and then within SARB, I think, and we've asked, Chair, the customs unit to come, because the movement of goods and services, trade pricing, is something that they would be at the front end on. But you get other issues. Aside from checking for tax revenue, you may be just checking for security. Okay? So if you're at an airport, you've got airport security, you've got customs. Okay, so you get into all those complexities. Do they share information? FIC receives your cash transaction records and your suspicious transaction records. The staff obviously has info on flows, particularly on outflows. For treasury, there's also PFMN, MFMA, and just if I go by the press, yeah, do we know that all state-owned entities and public sector outflows are approved appropriately? Do we not see static controls, and especially when they offshore operations? I think that these are questions that are out in the public domain, because they would also constitute illicit flows if something's not done in terms of the PFMA. And just to give you an example of all the players and the complexity, if you just looked at beneficial ownership, which is a big issue that came up with the Fifth Amendment bill, and where we lagging, who's the ultimate owners? Okay. So if you look at the JSE for listed companies, and bear in mind your thought, and I know people like Flock are better at it, so please come in if I'm wrong, but it's about when you own the owner of, let's say, shares in a company, you find it's not a person, it's some other company. If you find out who owns that, there's about three other structures that own that. It's a whole pyramid. But who's the ultimate owner is the question. Okay. Does the JSE have sufficient disclosure standards? Does the CIPC keep such information? In most cases, the answer is no, either way. If you look at pension and investment funds or whoever invests them, do you know who the ultimate persons are responsible for, aside from the members, for investing those funds? When you deal with trusts, again, you need to probably look at the Department of Justice and the Master's Office. Where do they fit in? If you look at a lot of illicit flows happen around properties, okay? We all hear about the London market and billionaires from certain countries who buy soccer teams and properties in London. You know, how are the deeds officers, are their records dematerialized? Are they updated? So that falls under the Department of Rural Affairs. So Chair, just, and I guess I'm sort of saying, we clearly don't have the type of coordination we need to have within government. There's some coordination, but it can always be improved. But similarly, can Parliament assist? Because, again, it's not just the one or three committees here. So if you look at just the examples that are given, we would hope that Parliament would be hard on us to hold us to account and to check on the quality of the coordination. But that would mean better coordination from Parliament between committees. And if you look at it, aside from the Standing Committee of Finance, there's the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry or Economic Development, which between them would have CIPC, Royalty and Intellectual Property Rights. You would have the Rural and Land Affairs, Property Deeds falls under it. Mineral Resources would deal with issues like mining licenses, and especially with regard to non-listed companies, okay? We need that info. Justice would deal with trust data, etc. Police and safety and security would deal with, obviously, between them and justice, they'll deal with the police, NPA, and if you deal with public enterprises, overseeing many of the state-owned entities and to what extent they comply with the PFMA. So, check what we could do today in this maze, this jungle, okay, is you've had this intro. We want to give you hard data because the two things you've asked us is Panama and what's new. So, all the teams will come in. So, you'll get the Reserve Bank coming first because they monitor some flows and they'll give you some info and we'll talk Panama. FIC will also come in on what they do, some of the data, and Panama. Then you'll get SARS coming in, which all deals with Panama. They'll deal with SARS pricing, trade mispricing, and just a brief report from customs. And then, in this time, we'll just give you an update on VAPS, because there's 15 actions there. All those are related to transfer pricing, but we'll just give you a brief update. So that's what, as a treasury family, we could give. But again, the main message that I have is, you also somewhat get a full picture, and we don't have the full picture as Treasury. There's all these other players that are out there and need to be also kind of involved. Thank you, Chair.
Just something I wasn't hoping to intrude, but the way you're raising questions, it could be seen as if government is flustered, bewildered, or so. I mean, you're raising questions that are good, but it's not consistent with what you've been saying until now in the team. That look, you're aware of the gravity of the problem, you're attending to it, you're increasing the number of staff in SARS. You gave us figures before of what you've been able to spend through the time and money and so on. Which, you know, you're quite proud. But the staff is so, it's more like a workshop type reflection. You know, you're saying, look, you don't really know how to use the problem and what is known and what's unknown. And then you're hanging out with people who are actually doing things in the maze of confusion that seems to be suggested by your initial input. I'm just saying it's fine, but it's like more like a workshop type situation. It's alerting entities to the complexities of the issues. But it's not as if you're doing nothing. That's all I want to communicate, because it's not consistent with the three or four sessions we've had with you over the last 18 months, you know. That's all I'm saying. So though I'm sure we appreciate the complexities of what you're pointing to, but presumably you are on the ball and you're doing what you can within the context of these things, right? Okay, all right, fine. Presented here. It's inconsistent, I'm just saying. I think members will agree. It's quite inconsistent what's been said to us up to now. It's more like a philosophical reflection. And it's coming a bit late. This could have been fine 18 months ago when we first met you, but it's more like an introspective, reflective, workshop type situation input, which you would presumably have amongst yourselves, and then come to us with ideas on. You didn't expect us to give you answers, obviously. You really expecting maybe too much. But having said that, it's fine. It's just that your introduction moment is slightly negative. So much so that suddenly you're skeptical now of what each of these factors are going to say. And this thing is not consistent with what's been happening over the last 18 months. Am I right? Everyone's other two chips here.
Let me tell you. I think I certainly want to get across how complex the issue is. Okay. Certainly, I think each of the agencies are doing that the best and they're expanding. But I'm saying this problem is so complex that you need much more than each silo or departmental family. And to the extent that there's more effective coordination, in a sense, the proof is in how many are actually prosecuted, how many are actually fined, and it's not South Africa's specific problem. But it's very hard to actually ensure that in a whole chain this is actually working. And it does require very, very different skills if you want to pick it up. And so I think to try and solve this in an incremental way, you'll solve small problems. But to the extent that there, if this is a big problem, how do you solve it? I think most countries, certain developing countries, face these challenges. And I don't want to come and say everything solves, everything's hunky-dory. We see too many stories in newspapers and so on. And the point is, I guess everyone, as a taxpayer, I would like to know when the story's there, but at least somebody's looking, somebody's going in, and the problem is actually sorted out either way, either the person's innocent, or there's something, or whatever.
The other thing I quickly say before we continue, the idea here was to get a quick briefing on a Panama Papers, right?
Yes.
We will have to find a fuller, accommodate colleagues, we'll have to find a fuller opportunity. The possibly best thing to do, if the two co-chairs agree, is the first week when we get back in August is a committee week. And we need a longer period. And actually, now less divisions. In fact, not officials at all. I thought we agreed on joint committees. The elephant thing, right? Joint committees are meant to start earlier because of a larger team and so on. So I apologize for that, actually. We should have started at least 9:30 or 9 and sat 1:30. But nothing stops us from sitting until 13:30 today. I can't be here, but you can continue. All I'm saying is, when the other people are making inputs, just understand it's the first of a two-page process. In exchange with you said all you all are still putting together panel paper stuff, right? And report to you with this time. So what we're saying to you is that in August we'll have a longer sitting with you and where we will be much more proactive and be clear. And we have sent you a whole lot of questions to our research. If you'd like to respond to that, that'll be distributed presumably here this morning. Alright, fine. Let's go over. Yes, you say something. Just help to structure the meeting and manage the time. If you can help in that regard, it'd be great. Yeah.
No, I'm not sure if I'd be that helpful, but I thought that, you know, you list Bess's 15 actions and the complexity of all of this. Whereas from our side of things as trade and industry, we thought transport for pricing, while complex, didn't have the same complexities as these other, you know, 11, as it were, issues. So the idea may be, what is it that can be done and is being done? More or less what you're saying. We need action. We can't wait and wait. We need to proceed. Thank you.
Okay, so to be clear, each of the presentations will show you the actions that are actually happening. And you'll see what's been done. But I think it's important to get the entire picture, but also know that, you know, if you're going to operate in silos, even if everyone's very successful, they're not going to be complete. You're not going to necessarily solve them. The big problem.
Honourable members, I will, in the interest of time, skip the index and move to the first slide. Just to tell what the South African Reserve Bank has been doing with illicit financial flows. But also to say that illicit financial flows started years ago prior to the Panama Papers. It's just the magnitude of the information that has been revealed maybe that made people to be concerned over the years. But it started years ago. Hence we had the 2003 amnesty. So the Reserve Bank is one of the strategic focus areas to monitor cross-border flows and also to prevent the abuse of the financial system. And in that regard, we work with other agencies as we have listed there, the SAPS, the FIC, SARS, and the SAU. We also do awareness training because in terms of the border control, the money that could flow through the ports, especially the airports, we work together with SARS in that regard. That, you know, we provide some guidance in that regard. And in terms of the legislation, we can actually stop the money once it has been taken, and once on what basis the money actually then be taken to people that are carrying money illegally out of the country. So we work together with other agencies in that regard. We could not do this work, you know, alone, unfortunately. And then we've increased enforcement action under exchange control regulations and FICA, because exchange control regulations are so vast, we can block. And we can also, where people cannot do representations in terms of where they got the funds from, the money would ultimately be forfeited to the state in the long run. And then we have actually identified high risk in the areas in terms of its flows, flight payments, advance payment for imports, where a lot of people will make cases to send money offshore, whether in some goods, especially capital goods, where they say, you know, the manufacturer will not be able to start the process without money going out. But in turn, in the long run, when you start to look in terms of whether there has been an import, you find that there has never been an import. So it's an unfortunate fact that we see that a lot of people are using this dispensation. And we also found unauthorized loss in foreign currency. That's the black market that we have found in Cape Town here, and also in Limpopo, where people are starting to sell dollars on the street. No change, Honourable Member. Okay. It just has, we might just be new all along, so it's fine. Oh, all right. No change. And then from the staff's point of view, taking from January 2015 to date, 135 bank accounts have been frozen as a result of suspected illicit financial fraud, and approximately out of those 145, there's about 307 million rand that has been blocked. And then we also have opened 77 new investigation cases during that period. And then we, as I said, we work with the enforcement agencies. They have been arrested in KZN, Mpumalanga, Western Cape, and Gauteng. And we see also a dramatic increase in terms of referrals. That will be tip-offs, you know, in terms of suspected transactions. However, in terms of the case themselves, we have started to see the reduction, because once people see that you are on their case in terms of illicit flows, or you understand the modus operandi that they do, sometimes you have an impact in that regard. then the offshore leaks, in terms of, you know, the information that has been leaked, offshore leaks is the name of the report disclosing, you know, details of 130,000 offshore accounts in April 2013. At the time of the leak, it was considered the biggest, you know, information leaked over a period of all times. So the offshore leaks comprise approximately 2.5 million secret accounts, you know, about offshore assets of people from 170 countries and territories. You can see below in terms of the graphs and information that this is one of the highest information that was released over a period of time. So the Panama Papers themselves, you know, is confidential information in the provision of, you know, trust services, could be wealth management, you know, international business structures and commercial law services by Panama Law Firm, the known firm that is Mossack Fonseca, for a client in offshore jurisdiction, because they've been facilitating this process of actually helping investors to actually hide their money in foreign jurisdiction. It doesn't mean that the Panama Papers money that has been transferred from various jurisdictions sitting in Panama. It could be gone through, you know, Panama, but in other jurisdictions, because so many of these jurisdictions around the world. And then the leak information provides information that exposes wealth held in offshore jurisdiction by individuals and entities. Normally, you know, entities that have been set up in the past, they used to use what you call, you know, Vieira shares, where they offer a high degree of anonymity and also ease of transferability, because once you have Vieira instrument, I can give it to my neighbor here when I like him or her very much, and from that one, she or he owns those particular shares. They still offer the benefit. I think the benefit in the past was in terms of inheritance, because it's easy to transfer, you know, inheritance and to avoid the hassle of administrative costs in the past. But as time goes on, they were using actually to launder money and actually to evade tax. And then, you know, we also provide insight in terms of how network individual structure hide their financial to minimize their tax exposure, because in terms of tax efficient jurisdiction, or what is called secrecy jurisdiction, is when people try to avoid tax, paying tax, you know, or appropriate tax amounts in their own countries and then go to this low jurisdiction and hide their money there so that they can rake in more profit at the end of the day. And disclose beneficial ownership of trust and entities. And this is what I alluded to, because one way to hide is actually to hide beneficial ownership. You have nominee holders or nominee directors, and you can use shell companies that you can buy off the shelf already with a tax number, with a corporate structure, with a credit history, whatsoever. But you never know the underlying owners of that particular company. And then, leave concerning possible tax evasion and money laundering, because you don't know actually who owns whom in that regard. There's details about enablers, because for these people to be able to do what they are doing, they don't have any expertise. You need an intermediary like this legal firm that is assisting people to create this structure. So sometimes you have to deal with the initiators of these processes that are actually helping these people to be able to create these structures, and not only focus with the money where it is, you know, in the end of the day. So the lead information consists of 11.5 million documents covering, you know, services performed between 1970 and early 2016. As I added to this, started long, long, long time ago. It's just that maybe now that it has been revealed and the magnitude, you know, it becomes a great concern. And then, you know, you know that it was leaked by the newspapers. There's this consortium of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, of which South Africans have got membership, few journalists are membership of that. And they have been releasing the information in the newspapers, you know, in tranches. You know, we don't have, I think at this stage, fully fledged information on. I believe now there are tranches that will still come, and we are monitoring them. From the Reserve Bank side, as we see this information, because of the cross-border system, we try and compare what is on the cross-border system, because if you transfer money from South Africa, from the Reserve Bank point, that money is captured on the system. But it doesn't mean sometimes that everything that is captured is legal sometimes, because people sometimes use fake documents and also check that. Mm-hmm. So in terms of important consideration, individuals in South Africa in terms of exchange control, they are free to transfer 10 million per annum out of the country. You can take it to whatever jurisdiction you want to take it, plus 1 million, you know, that you can add for discretionary allowance. And then, you know, the problem with the Panama Papers database, it offers us that limited information, and some of the information because it goes since 1970, it's outdated. Or some of the perpetrators in that regard that you might find today, you might find that yes, they transferred the money in the 70s, or and then come 2003 they availed of the 2003 or the 2010 VDB. So we are still evaluating the first complex data of individual entities implicated in the lifting function because we work with us in this regard, consider possible contraventions of relevant financial disclosure requirements and determine whether offshore funds have any nexus to criminality. Because sometimes offshore funds, when they go offshore, there's this notion today that says for the money. So that you can see where it ends up. Because some of the money goes out of South Africa, then it returns and it pays an individual that are involved in the various activities. So we try and see if we can follow the money. Determine whether it does contravene any South African legislation in setting up the financial structure. Because in setting up the financial structure, there are some regulations and some regulator that you have to go through in order to set up that structure. You cannot just decide, I'm going to set up a structure anywhere in the world without certain approvals that come from certain regulators. And then identify possible occurrences of exchange control violations that we monitor, that if there are exchange control violations that we discover, as an entity that we can actually block their account, and then in the end we'll be able to, once we verify all the facts that actually you cannot prove what those funds you bought them from and what we're using them for, and then it can be actually confiscated by the state. Thank you, James.
But overall, the tendency is up and will continue to increase. We now have over 1 million suspicious transactions in the database, and we have over 25 million cash transaction reports in the database as well. And what's important is we're constantly updating and modernizing the IT capability to be able to crunch this and other data, which leads to all sorts of interesting results. If we look at the priority areas for the Financial Intelligence Center, and again, those have developed over the last 5-6 years or so, and I want to look at the 2015-2016 year, those blocks and all of those bits and pieces determine the focus area for the FIC. We don't simply receive data coming in and then try and make sense of it. We set it against the priorities determined by the law enforcement investigating authorities on the one hand and the intelligence services on the other. So they're crime priorities, they're national security priorities, and that then helps us to look for what we need to look so we can then assist them in their investigations. And we can talk to that if you would wish a bit more later. On the performance in the last year, just to quickly run through the number of reports received in the second last column, 2014-15, 6.9 reports received, which includes the full gamut of suspicious transactions, cash transactions, and so on. And there's a breakdown there. Only 18 in relation to terror property, in other words, the financing of terrorism, which is probably a good sign for us as a country and in terms of our security issues, national security issues. If we go to the next slide, better utilization of financial intelligence, and again, a second last column. The number of cases that the FIC has disseminated sits 870, and that's for investigation. And then the requests responded to by international counterparts sitting at 1,799. Then there's a temporary blocking of funds to enable departments to take back the money at 181 million. And then, very importantly, the last block, there are 22 judicial actions, which extends our mandate somewhat, but means that FIB staff are appearing as expert witnesses in court matters. If we look at the next slide, you'll see some of the matters referred to for investigation, and the last three, four are the key areas: corruption, crimes against the state, fraud, and money laundering. Moving over, we then deal with some of the crime types, and again we can discuss that. What's important there are terrorism, robbery, there's a lot of work on national security and terror-related matters, even though there are a few reports. And then fraud is a key area that we've been working on. And then all of the departments that we work with on the law enforcement side and the relationships we have. So we're not working in isolation from, but we're working with that wide range of investigative authorities. Moving on then to the illicit economy and the financial flows. Here we set up a small project which ran for 2 years to try and understand firstly the illicit flows, but in relation to the illicit / illegal economy, we have to understand from our perspective what is the illegal economy and what drives the generation of proceeds of crime. And that was our major focus in all of this. That then led on in the last year to an understanding of virtual currencies because of the threat that they pose to our financial system, Bitcoin and blockchain technology. I believe there was a workshop in Parliament here around that. And then also determine how we better coordinate efforts with law enforcement authorities and others. And most importantly, the value chains linked to specific types of crime. Crime is not a one-off. It's a process, and in many instances, it's a business. And we need to understand all the components of that in order to be able to intervene appropriately, each one of the respective authorities. And then also to hone up our definition and understanding, which is an operating understanding, of the illicit economy, the legal economy. On the illicit financial flows, I just want to make the point that there's a background context which MoMA has touched on. For us, the FATF, which stands for the Financial Action Task Force, those standards are paramount. And in particular, the FATF did some work, which SARS have been involved in along with ourselves, on trade-based money laundering, which then links to the transfer pricing issues and so on, which is a very good piece of work, and it's possible that it should fit into the committee at some point in the near future, as well as in the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime and the OECD. We've worked with them, also trying to understand transnational crime, particularly narcotics, terrorism, and human trafficking, and the flows associated with those, how they generate, where they move cross. So that's high level stuff, but that provides the backdrop. The illicit financial flows, as Mehmet says, very difficult to measure. Notwithstanding all the numbers out there, very difficult to measure, and the existing methodologies only give crude estimates. They do not give precise numbers at all. Moving on, we then use a working definition for the illicit stroke illegal economy. All illegal acts, economic activities which generate proceeds, escaping government, law enforcement agencies, regulators, observation, and regulation and taxation. In other words, it's in that dark space that creates the proceeds. That's what we work with, that's what we look at. There are two slides which certainly I think both Trade and Industry Committee and the SCOP have seen before, giving a description of that, and I think we can come back to that if you wish later on, but the merger of the illicit and the legal, illicit, illegal, and how they generate and how money then gets moved and potentially then escapes our borders as well. And then moving on to the last slide, the results. We deliberately, in this project, sought to engage with as many different stakeholders across the board as possible. And in fact, we had a large number of workshops, both within the economic cluster, but also within the justice crime prevention cluster. And getting particularly the crime prevention side to understand the role of finance and money in relation to crime and beginning to help focus their efforts there. Broadly, we clump the illicit finance into three categories. There's the transfer pricing issue, which is probably the largest by a long way, the criminal activities, which includes all the narcotics and so on, and then the corruption and other stuff, which is a very small quantum in relation to the overall. A lot of work was done with DPCI, a lot of work was done within NICOC structures to look at the value chains, and there's a mapping of that, and that's helped develop a strategic the focus and the intention to be able to intervene appropriately. And ultimately, I think that's what we've now understand, we have a better appreciation of the business of crime, the financial component, and as Elijah's speaking about, where the lack of transparency enables hidden financial flows, which the Panama Office is concerned. So the lack of transparency, which we would posit as a serious flaw. Challenges going ahead, and reiterating some of what Mr. Mamonian says, that the illicit financial flows are the subset of an illegal economy that we're interested in. We need to understand it in much, much more detail. It certainly requires a national policy chair. It's going to require long-term multidisciplinary implementation processes and plans. It's going to require different clusters, finance, economic, the justice and security, as well as ministers such as DIRCO. The list of financial flows requires DIRCO intervention from time to time as well. You need to understand issues. It needs granular research. Models, methodologies have to be developed to be able to do the research. And then policy development and coordination. And I sort of, again, make the link to the Panama Papers in that we see that disclosure and transparency is critical, and we need to have the wherewithal to pierce the corporate veil to be able to get to the bottom of these things. On the Panama Papers, I'd also like to share with you, Chair, that the FIC, I made the decision a few days ago last week, and that there are inspection happening of those entities that have enabled the Panama Papers actions to have occurred. Those inspections are taking place at the moment. Have they met the FIC Act obligations? Customer diligence provisions, registration, and reporting. And that's taking place at the moment. So, Chair, very quickly, high level, that's our report to you.
We've got the hard text while the IT people are responding.
Okay, thank you. You will find what I'm going to present towards the middle of this, you will find towards the middle of the pack. We will deal with that first, and then we'll revert back to the feedback on the four action items. I'm sorry.
I'm going to skip a number of these slides. They have already been dealt with by both SELP and the FIC. And I'm going to jump right into the numbers. You can always refer to that. That one. But we're going to move off this one. I think you know by now that we're talking about 11.5 million in eternal files. The real issue here is that we don't have those files, and that must be remembered. None of us have got access to those files at the moment. We only have data that the ICI Day have linked their SARS. SARS, so we on this. Here in end of March, beginning of April this year, we got invited to the what we call JISIC. It's a joint international tax shelter information and collaboration network. It's a very long name, but it consists of a number of tax administrators around the world. It's part of the Forum on Tax Administration. So on 13 April 2016, the committee there met. It was a one-day meeting to find out what each of these tax administrators will be doing and have been doing, and you know, to on that date, an action plan was agreed upon by worldwide tax administrators, aimed at obtaining more information and sharing it more efficiently among the tax administrators. So, at the moment, what we've done is we've, of course, like the other agencies, we've downloaded the data, we've converted it to a special format. We've identified roughly 1,700 individual South African resident names. That's after we've removed the duplicates. They also vary from shareholders, directors, beneficiaries. We've identified 56 South African intermediaries. What's the next slide? What I've tried to set out here in the next few slides are different variations of how they have set this up. If you go towards the left of the slide, you will see, and I'm happy to convert the black into grey, but you will see the client, which is a South African resident. You would then, normally, you would have an intermediary, but you may or may not have an intermediary. So either the client or the intermediary would then go to Mossack, which is a legal firm in Panama. It could be any legal firm anywhere in the world, but you would only find them in the tax havens. Mossack would then set up the company that's, it looks like a little blue building on the right hand side, that is the company. Mossack would also appoint nominee directors. So immediately the link between the company and the South African resident is gone. And it is only captured in the underlying supporting documents that you will find in the offices of Mossack. And then the company will set up a bank account either in the same country or, as you will see on the next slide, the bank could also be in another jurisdiction, which again breaks the link. On the third slide, all that's going on there is we've inserted a trust on top, and that just makes the link more invisible. So we've now started to match the data. So far we've been able to identify 79 of a total of 560 offshore entities that we've been able to match against our database. So we know there's 560 of them. We've been able to match so far 79 of them. This is ongoing, so as we go along, this number will grow. And so we've been able to link 81 SA residents with those 79 offshore companies. Inside SARS, we've set up a unit that would manage the whole thing. We don't want everyone's SARS running around asking information about a Panama at the banks or wherever. And we are now doing our best to match the rest of the names with the entities so that we can start to see how the attacks and about calls are being like. It is, of course, at the moment too early to predict the level of tax avoidance or evasion, because remember that we do not have any amounts or any estimate of the values that are lying in those bank accounts at the moment. No one has. Actually, that's about it. We would, of course, allow the residents to make use of VDP, even the special VDP that we'll be introducing 1st of October, but that is, of course, if we don't get to them for 1st of October. If we get to them before 1st of October, which I think we may, then they won't be able to make use of the special VDP. And I think that sums up the position of the source at the moment related to a family.
Okay, then policy disclosure, well, the committee will process in August, early September. You certainly have it before the end of October. Especially, you might know the FICA bill has been processed by the FAOP, and I think it's being debated either today or tomorrow. So that bill will, is it today, Mr. Jenkins? Good. Okay, just to remind people, we had a whole day workshop on the concepts and so on. Those who didn't attend, I think it would be unfair to burden us with their problems. We had a whole from 10 o'clock to 10 o'clock. So the two chairs here will just rule you out. You're asking questions that have been covered before, because it's not going to be those of us who attended. Having said that, over to you. Ideally, 3 minutes. But let's see how many people in the first instance got to speak. And you know your numbers, okay? I can't remember all of that, and you could count by now. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So in that case, if it's where it is, up to 5 minutes. Yes. Sorry, I forgot you. Younger, I see you become the IT expert here. Oh, okay, the IT expert.
Okay, good morning everybody. My name is Nishana Gosai and I'm from SARS Transport Pricing. Just touching upon the best action items, like Momo said initially, out of the 15 action items, 4 were related to transport pricing and about 2 others or 3 others touched upon transport pricing. The 4 key best action items were actions 8 to 10 and 13. In terms of actions 8 to 10, they dealt largely with the issue of substance. And substance around certain transaction types like intangibles, how to value intangibles, the contractual allocation of risk and capital, and other high-risk transactions such as base loading payments like management fees and things like that, and also the issue of recharacterization. And what does this mean in a nutshell? Basically, for intangibles, people got tired of saying, well, just because the legal owner is sitting in a low-tax jurisdiction, they should be entitled to intangible-related returns. The thinking now is that we will no longer just blindly accept legal contracts and legal ownership, and without looking at the substance of where the economic activity generating those IP is performed. In terms of contractual allocation of risk and capital, that was dealt with on the premise that it's a common economic principle that profits follow risk. And what we started to see was paper allocations and paper transfers of risk without those entities actually being able to bear such risk. Looking at capital, it became commonplace that you had so-called cash boxes resident in a low-tax jurisdiction. And just because they provided capital, which the flows and how the capital got into the low-tax jurisdiction is questionable, the thinking was that they are entitled to all the profits. That's no longer the case. So the underlying premise is that now value and where economic activity takes place as to where legal contracts reside are no longer commonplace. When you look at other high-risk transactions, we dealt with recharacterization and bringing or altering those contracts in order to align conduct and contract. So that's where we were actions 8 to 10. What does this mean for South Africa and for transfer pricing? We said previously we've always had transfer pricing legislation. It's been around since 1995. But what has happened is that these revisions and sending out of the best action items is going to go a long way towards helping us to reinforce and to audit and monitor and track our transfer pricing transgressors. But over and above that, South African Revenue Services said, all right, this is what the best action item said, we revised the guidelines, well and good. But what can we at a domestic level do to enhance our capability to sort of audit and to get to the heart of the transgressors? So what did we do? Last year when I came, I talked a lot about some of the challenges we experienced, the diversion, deflection, delaying tactics of taxpayers, that where they fail to provide information to us, does not assist the revenue authority to make a meaningful audit conclusion. It doesn't allow us to raise assessment. So on the back of the BEPS and the momentum that we're getting on the BEPS outcome, working together with National Treasury, we came up with a few regulations. And what did we do? In December last year, we issued a public notice enhancing our documentation and record-keeping requirements for transfer pricing. We had public consultation with business on the 9th of May, and I think the feeling from the sector is that this is a very hard-hitting, and it's actually quite a milestone progress, because right up from now, since 1995, SARS has never had transfer pricing records or documentation record-keeping as a statutory requirement. Now it is. Public officers having to sign off tax returns are going to be now under severe pressure to go back and look, are we in compliance with this record-keeping notice. Further, we inserted Section 42A in the Tax Administration Act to clarify the requirements to be met against taxpayers failing to provide information to the SARS. One of the common tactics used is that they claim legal privilege. Now we've put in very stringent measures to say, well, if you're going to put that claim in, what are the criteria that needs to be met, and what are the rights and powers of SARS? And we set a process that in the instance of a stalemate, we have got an independent judicial peek. We've amended Section 46 of the TAR in order to access foreign-based information. As you know, transfer pricing relates to cross-border transactions, which one party to the transaction is always sitting offshore. A large part of the hindrance to auditing transfer pricing transgression was failure of SARS to get offshore information. So now we put in a mechanism for us to get that. We've also put in a backstop to say taxpayers who do not provide such information on the basis that it's sitting offshore, well, they may be prohibited from providing it later in the event that it helps them. So they've checked the balances in place. We've amended Section 47 of the Tax Administration Act, clarifying persons who may be interviewed or called on to provide information on a company or entity under audit. A lot of taxpayers thought, well, you know, a multinational is an entity, it's a legal persona, but there are people in those legal entities that have information. And one of the things that SARS identified is that there might have been some loophole around that person providing information on the activities of the company. Well, now we've clarified that to close that gap. We've also amended Section 49 of the TAR to say such persons will have to do so under oath or solemn declaration. The reason for that is that, you know, unless people feel that there is a strong deterrent, a common answer might be, well, I don't know, or I was not aware. You can't use that cop-out now, because now we're asking you to declare under solemn oath. We have further amended Section 99 of the TAR, extending the prescription period and the statute of limitations. One of the things that we found is that taxpayers will play the prescription game, and when SARS is ready to actually raise an assessment, oops, sorry, you're out of time. So now we've got strict rules around extending prescription timelines. We've also made inbound services a reportable arrangement. These inbound services were listed in the best action items as being a very a significant base eroding payment for developing countries. So by including this in the TAR, we are able now to better track it and hopefully audit it. We also broaden the corporate income tax return to improve and increase the disclosure requirements for transfer pricing and other BEPS-related transactions. So we implemented measures 18 months ago, and on completion of the BEPS project, we are further undertaking exercises with ourselves to say how better can we improve this. In terms of Action 13, this addresses the pillar of transparency. Again, we found documentation is key to any audit. and to the conclusion of an audit. So OECD action items recommended a three-tier approach, which was a master file talking about your overall group, your local file, that's disseminating the overall group structure to a local level, and then the country-by-country reporting, which was provide almost a macro shot of the entire M&E group with certain key triggers of economic activity, such as, you know, taxes paid, which jurisdiction you reside in, what is your capital structure, how many people do you employ, etc. The CDC report, as it is commonly known, is regarded as the minimum standard, and South Africa has just passed legislation to incorporate filings of the CDC in our jurisdiction. We've also got further initiatives to incorporate or to clarify local file and master file for our jurisdiction, and that will be released later this year. Last year, when I came, I talked about now you want to get into the numbers. Last year, we reported that over a three-year period, we tracked income and made adjustments to the tune of 20 billion, which resulted in about 5 billion in actual tax collection. This year, for the 2015-2016 financial year, tax collections relating to transfer pricing for SRs approximated to about 815 million. This resulted from three key sectors, mining and quarrying at 721 million, oil refinery at 94, and manufacturing at 42.5 million. Now, if people think the number is too low, there's an explanation for that, but if you think it's good enough, I'll move on. What is the current status? We have 29 cases in audit, and this spans multiple years. So there are 29 taxpayers currently under review, but please note that these span multiple years of inquiry. I've given you a breakdown of which sectors they relate to and just some of the risks that we've identified. In terms of our transfer pricing capacity, SRs, we currently have 25 members in the team. We have a recruitment process underway for hiring additional capacity, and we have a dedicated training program to continue to upskill and increase and enhance our capacity. In terms of some of the challenges around capacity, it has to be said that there's a scarcity of experienced resources, and this is a global phenomenon. I think all tax administrations, including the advisory firms, are struggling. The advisory firms locally are actually resorting to hiring foreign skills, seconding them on a basis of 3 years to come and assist with capacity. There's also a huge competition between public sector and private sector. It's common knowledge that private sector pays phenomenally well. Transfer pricing experience skills are very well paid, so there's that competition factor that you have to live with. On a positive note, though, some of the reasons that SARS or public sector has been able to retain transfer pricing skills is due to the diversity of the work and exposure and, you know, subscribing to the higher mandate and making a difference. The challenge with hiring from outside as opposed to building from within is that people from the outside come with no audit experience from a tax authority perspective. They're unfamiliar with SARS governance and internal processes, and it takes a while for them to assimilate into the system. In terms of leveraging international best practice and staying abreast and ensuring that we're continually refining and improving our jobs, SARS remains committed to participating in international fora. So last year we participated in the UN Manual on Practical Issues in the area of transfer pricing. SARS actually sits on the steering committee to enhance transfer pricing capability in developing countries. We participate in the OECD's Working Party 6, which is the working party dedicated to the taxation of multinationals. We have also participated and sent our staff on workshops, such as the UN Primal Workshop in Lusaka, Zambia this year. This was the inaugural launch of the UN's course on transfer pricing based on its own transfer pricing manual. SARS also attended the ASAP summit in Kenya. This summit was a sitting of the ASAP Cross-Border Taxation Technical Committee, of which SARS has membership. We participate in the updates to the UN Transfer Pricing Manual. There was a meeting in Santiago in November 2015, and South has representation on the UN Subcommittee on Transfer Pricing. And we currently have efforts underway to receive training from the IRS in the US, Canada, Australia, and the UK. Thank you.
Chair, I will slide on trade pricing. If you allow me to introduce myself, I'm Richard Lewis, or Dr. Richard Lewis, and like my colleagues from GFI, or from SCI, indicated that the GFI reports all high level. It tells you numbers at a high level, macroeconomic level. And we are focusing on doing research and analysis at the academic level to get grips with how big is this trade, and this invoicing on trade, this pricing. And for that purpose, I put a couple of slides together. It is a concern that these numbers are enormous. So what we are currently doing, we selected a subsector of the economy. It's got wide-ranging impact on other sides of the economy, so it's not an isolated subsector. In undertaking such granular research, data availability is critical. And within that, we rely on data statistics, as well as product pricing data that we use and analyze. And we get case research and analysis down to an economic entity level. Because if you ask me which door I'm going to knock on, I should be able to answer you, because that's the ultimate objective. And then we need to test the research and analysis based on the pricing information as well as the trade statistics to the financial information of the entities within that subsector. So you need to do some data mapping, some data matching. It manifests itself in two ways, as highlighted by the GFI reports, either as import over invoicing, or alternatively, there also happens as export under invoicing, and we're looking at both those transactional flows. Thank you, Chair.
I'll be concerned with the as much. My presentation mainly supplements or complements most of the presentations made earlier. As we are at the core phase of what's taking place at most of the point of entry into the country. My name is William from Customs Operations, thank you. I think that I thought it might be a good idea just to update the policy on the customs mandate, which is the control of goods flowing in and out of the country, the collection of duties to the protection of society from harmful goods, the protection of the economy. And everything we do this with about 2,597 officers present at 10 airports, 8 seaports, 7 school ports, 2 direct ports, and 1 inland airport in Jefferson. And our capability includes non-exclusive technologies such as scanners, which are body scanners, cargo scanners, rail scanners, and body scanners. We also make use of detector docks, which have been implemented to sniff out currency. And in addition to what the Fed Bank has already presented in terms of simulated import transaction, we have started detecting the movement of hard currency through our borders. Prices, precious metal as store of value, tobacco and tobacco products, health products, as well as copper. The next slide. The type of precious metals that we have detected so far include diamonds and gold, currency, USD, euros, money orders, and even South African rand. From a crisis perspective, I know on, which is a hot topic. Narcotics, which could be used to strengthen as part of money laundering, tobacco, which is what we call cigarettes and other tobacco products, and health products such as Viagra, contraceptives, skin lighting creams, and the like. Moving to hard facts themselves, something that would be interesting to this comment, I think, is that two large items there, that is gold and currency, and amongst the which are the significant ones that we have detected so far, is about 18 million rands from a gold effective, 14 million rands, and about 73 million rands. terms of currency, those are the methods that I use, USD to access South African rand, euros, USD money orders, and euros as well as assets. The big amount that we have detected so far is 9 million rand through the OCR as well as about 7 million rand through Kinshasa Airport presently. The next slide is a headyard or the places where this commodities come to. And as I said, the interesting part to this contributed the two last part of the presentation of the slide there, which is the currency and gold. And those are the areas where we have detected this going to or coming into the country from, and the methods of concealment in terms of getting some of these commodities in and out of the country. Now, if you increase our capacity just from a fiscal point of view, an operational point of view, we are planning to also extend our capability in terms of technology scanners in some of the areas that we are not covering the areas or the cost of entry, as well as increasing our detector dock capacity. And that actually shows us the program going forward, how we'll be doing that in terms of rolling out as a program. The current scanner capacity at the moment is at those border posts and airports, as well as seaports, etc. Thank you. The next slide just shows the image of some of the images and our detected dogs in operation and how we detected some of the things. The concealment methods. I think the interesting one is on your right hand side, where we found some concealment in a game console right over here. And this is what's actually in our Higgs at a particular time. Thanks, citizen. That will be all. Thanks.
Last one. Can we just have an update on Gareth's chair? We've already prescriptive, but it will help if members contribute towards evolving our program so that the chairs can. Otherwise, you know what? It becomes not implying anything. It's like, actually, we elect the chairs more. It becomes like a feel good look within our oversight thing. Right? Antonio and Dumasani, please, you have to see. The other thing, Cindy, is not your fault. Once again, all of this comes to us this morning. Yesterday, we got 800, 900 pages at 20 per page to read. I told them, hey, even in the US, if you gave MPs 6 months to read 900 pages, they ain't going to read it. Right? So it's pretty easy to come because, frankly, the connection is very competent, very pretty. Right? You know, it's very good stuff you're giving us. And so can you summarize this, Antonio? Where are you? You're going to summarize this, right? And write up a report. This is the first instance. Right? Pick up the themes from here. Link it to Jumasani's earlier reports. He did about two or three, right? Over the last 18 months. Then we must contribute towards you guys doing a report on where we go from here. So when we meet again, we are clearer about what it is we're wanting from them. And we're not having the same ground. So ask your question. But help towards a program. Thank you, David.
Thank you, Chair. I know you're pressed for time. I'll be brief. I think it's well known and it's a matter of public record that for some time I've been calling for an investigation into allegations surrounding whether the Guptas illegally removed assets, including large amounts of cash, from South Africa. And what I've got in response is bureaucratic stalling and zigzagging. So specifically, I'd like to ask SARS Customs whether the Guptas properly cleared customs and whether their baggage was properly inspected before they left Lanseria on or about the 10th of April 2016, and then more generally, whether any institution is in fact seized with this matter and investigated. Because the effect, Chair, of the obfuscation is to suggest that the matter, which is of huge public interest, is not being investigated, and that inevitably undermines public trust in the institutions who are responsible for these investigations. That's the first question. The second question is to the Reserve Bank. I was a little bit concerned about the presentation because it appears that the Reserve Bank were not aware that the full ICIJ database is now available, and it doesn't appear from their presentation that the Reserve Bank are in fact seized with this matter and are doing anything about the data released under the rubric of the so-called Panama Papers. So I'm at least the side would concede that in fact they are mistaken, and whether they would outline what it is they plan to do about the Panama Papers. And then finally, a question to SARS. I've had a look through the database. I'm delighted to hear that SARS are in fact looking into the data released by the ICIJ. A quick search of the database reveals a search under the name Zuma, 3 hits under the name Sheikh, 3 hits under the name Bukta, 5 hits. I wonder if the Reserve Bank could confirm that, I wonder if the SARS could confirm, I beg your pardon, whether the entities that result from a search under those names are included in their investigation. Thank you.
Kali will be number 6, if it's correct. Right. Just go in order. Don't wait for us. You're on.
Thanks, Chairperson. First, I just want to welcome all of the reports, in particular the SARS transfer pricing unit and the trade misinvoicing search input. It seems, because I agree with Chairperson Karim, that Treasury in the beginning gave an overview that almost sounded like it was the first time that you'd ever come to Parliament to talk about this, because basically you said you don't know what illicit flows are. And if you don't know what illicit flows are, then who knows? So, I mean, fundamentally, it seems we've been talking about this years and years, and now you've come to us to say that it's very complicated and we're not quite sure what it is yet, but give us some time. I'd like to propose that we, Parliament, set up an ad hoc committee to look into financial, illicit financial flows, and that we can come up through the ad hoc committee with bringing everybody together to stop the silo situation. I'd also like to know, of the 81 people that have been identified, what percentage of those people are non-white? If you could tell us that, because I'd like to know where the real rich is. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Let me align myself with the previous speaker. First of all, Chair, I think it's very important for us to emphasize the importance of getting the different entities to work together on these flows. And Chair, there was a proposal, you came to me as a proposal more than a challenge. It came from Speaker, and I think we need to adopt it, and probably late Speaker, speak in the center office as the coordinating entity in terms of this, because to me, really, without data, whether if you are going to be leading by fact, you need some kind of data. Whether that data is not a reflection of the reality out there, but at least you have something to work with. And I think it's a nice disappointment with the first presentation, because how can at this stage we are still dealing with conceptual issues? This is no longer a conceptual issue. The African Union has even developed a slogan, stop it and get it. And it has even been able to quantify, to a certain extent. Of course, they do identify some weaknesses with the data that they have. They are estimating that over the last 50 years, probably we've lost about 15 trillion in the continent. And surely, you should be able in South Africa to ascertain to understand what sort of in that 50 trillion, how much of that it will be attributed to South Africa. We need to be working with something. We need to have some data. And really, I really support the idea of actually establishing a structure. And also, I'm also saying we need to have the formal structure if there isn't any. Because this is serious. To me, this issue of illicit economy is a new type of colonialism, if you like, which is digital, which is high-tech, and which is, you know, and it has all the reasons of colonialism. The devastation we have of colonialism, we are actually going to be experiencing that if this thing is not addressed appropriately. And I think it is for that reason that the African Union has actually made this issue part of one of the key agendas of the African Union. And I'm going to appeal to our taking class, honestly, not to fail us. We need to work with some kind of data. We are not going to be able as politicians to come here and again we are going over and over on contextual issues. Jay, I also want to say, we have to be careful as politicians not to be overly excited about just one family. We need to go beyond just the Kupas. The Kupas are not the only country. We are giving people who are in the services industry, who are advising government, who are also involved in profit shipping and trying to fix it. We know and this thing is very important that we need to be. So I'm not saying let's not work if there's that means anything wrong with prison. But let's not just be obsessed about one family. Africa is losing over $750 billion annually, and that is a very conservative statistic from the African Union. Surely they can't just be the voters. Surely other parties reflected in the fact, and I'm going to ask men to read carefully the presentation of SAR, because what we are beginning to get from SAR, they are beginning to give us an indication of what is happening in this space. And they are telling us that these are the areas that are posing as a serious challenge. And I also want to say, Chair, this is the final one. Pinky and myself are this, and I'm also speaking on Pinky. You know, Chair, there are chronic weaknesses with the tracking of these illicit loans. The problem is that you get a truck that comes through Devon, and it's supposed to be going to Malawi, and but it never gets to whatever border. And we, in South Africa, I have a feeling that we are simply not tracking enough. And I think we need to adopt the slogan of the AU, and South Africa, let's be in the forefront of the AU campaign of track it, stop it, get it. We have to be in the forefront of South Africa because we have the biggest port. It's here in South Africa. And if there are people that are going to be able to play a critical space in this, which is undermining our developmental agenda, it is us in South Africa. And here I'm really appealing to our people to please not, you know, to begin to assist us in this. And given the presentations that they've given us, I do believe that, you know, if this information was consolidated, and probably they have an opportunity to meet, we would probably be having a more qualitative discussion on this, because there is some kind of data that we can work on. And finally, I am again proposing that SPIC must be at the center of this, and maybe as the planning committee on finance, we probably do need to have probably twice a year or maybe quarterly have a report from SPIC to tell us what is happening in that front and bring the data. We need to find the data. We can no longer now continue talking about concepts and whatnot. This is a reality, and it's a threat to our development agenda. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, may I point out that I understand why it's impossible to quantify this advance. I think it was very clearly made, and we should not be lied to with an estimate, which is no more than calculated gain. However, it is possible to report what illicit funds have been found in the past. Perhaps that will give people some idea and they can extrapolate for themselves. Bottom line is, it doesn't matter how much it is, it's too much. And if we don't have a mechanism in place, which we do, it will just grow. Because, and from that point, I think there's a misconception that can maybe politicized or whatever, that we are behind when it comes to transfer pricing and base erosion. And I think we should take note of the fact that thanks to exchange control and the previous apartheid government's rules, South Africa's been at the forefront of base erosion, even though it wasn't called base erosion back then, and transfer pricing. And as a tax base issue in more than one country, I can tell you our rules are far more sophisticated and are leading the way. So my question to the members of the various institutes here is, what do we need to do more, what do you need us to do more to help prevent the illicit flow of funds? I think our legislation is pretty tight. I don't think there's a way you can get away with it without getting caught and prosecuted theoretically. So the size of the justice system has to be checked up. Well, what do you need us to do? I presume you need more scanners, etc. But what else is there that would help to stop this these funds trend and also?
Thank you very much, Chairperson and Police. The bottom line effect of transferring revenue offshore illegally from South Africa and importing goods into South Africa to be sold at a profit without declaring those goods is exactly the same effect. We'll agree on that. So what really interests me, and you'll know that I am becoming something of a sub record on this in the Trade Industry Committee, but I'll keep honest, is SARS' lack of attention to under-invoicing in importing, and specifically not so much at the border, but behind the border when those goods are in the country, and we know exactly where they are, yet there's very little attention paid to actually tracking them down and seizing them. So, for example, I continuously raise the example of the preponderance of China malls across the country. There's four or five within a Cape Town, more growing every month, and the trend is absolutely the same across the country. We all know that those malls are only able to offer the prices they offer because those goods are under invoice or not invoiced at all at the border, and no duties are paid on their imports. And yet, I've asked this question in the past, SARS is unable to provide a single example of a raid on a China mall in South Africa that has led to convictions or fines or prosecutions of those guilty of importing those goods without paying the necessary duties. So when we put on the screen a slide about illicit flows, I don't think it should just be guns and drugs and money. It would also be ordinary consumer goods that are brought into the country without paying any duties on them. And so I am happy to report SARS's efforts to stop those goods at the border with the 2,700 officers that you say you have. But once those goods are in the country, we know where they are. Let's go and get it. But I have not seen the requisite efforts being displayed in attempting to do that. And if that is incorrect, please provide me with the details.
Yeah, sure. Thank you very much. Let me first start by saying I appreciate the fact that in my lifetime, still a member of parliament, I see government departments in one room working together. It was one thing that Honorable John Thompson, remember, we used to face many years ago. Even to have committees in one room, it was an issue that we were preaching about many years ago. So to have it today, it's quite an achievement for parliament and for government. So to me, the starting point, in future, we have that journey where there will be no difficulties to compile one report by three or four government departments. So it will be too early to call it a day and be a prophet of doom in that regard. But my take, Chair, before I even ask my questions, yesterday I read the response by the Global Financial Integrity on the Panama Papers. And one of the things they raised in their report was that it is very difficult. In fact, they were saying there's a misuse of cooperation on the set liability companies. And that is a very serious threat to take off. So they're putting it up front. That is a basic method that should be taken into account.
and they were basing it on what the United States law enforcement companies have been doing in relation to illicit flows. And they emphasize, particularly on shell companies, the role of shell companies, making it very difficult to get to the beneficial owner. So I want us to zoom into that moment, to look at the performance of shell companies, how they hide the beneficial owner, and take into account the FI work in this regard and the workshops they have held to try and look at the role of shell and speak to what people have earlier said to follow the money and how it's being treated and how it comes to the country. But let me ask this specific question, because they will help in testing criminality. Difficult as it may, because we can speak a tracing illicit flow and also it's a very complex work in itself. So one thing I want to understand is that what type of systems that we have, do we have in place to test whether an entity is a legal entity or not? And it goes to be in this particular instance. How do you test that the legal entity? And in terms of staff, your system, how much can you take of what is captured? All the money that has been captured, which one can you say in this context? This is legal money and this is dirty money. Because then it means you will have tapped into what I said on Zoom into the shop companies that they are role. But that brings also the element of the role of law enforcement agencies. Because law enforcement agencies in this context will wait for staff or people to come to them and say, with respect, there is something untoward in relation to the shop company, they will want you to investigate. And then you start investigation. As long as you don't provide that person, or else the other way around. When they come to you and say, can you provide information in this regard? How do you do? Because testing criminality when there's a shop company sitting there and the book things between do not give you that opportunity to check whether there's a system and so on. And I want to raise in addition that illicit outflow doesn't happen where you'll be able to change the book. It's not money that goes through the book. And I'm mentioning this because I want to overemphasize my staff must not leave our borders. Because there is an element of the Department of Home Affairs wanting to take that special occupation that is being exercised by staff. It's only the expertise of staff, the parents and everything else that can be able to detect what the containers as they do ashore have inside and be able to as well as the information about the company written in the container it's relative or relevant to what you have in the book. So once you move staff from the book post, you will not be able to keep those expectations that I believe that Roma has that movement. So we should in our report share, and it's a foundation that you just must make, we should insist in our report that staff should continue be posted as a border post to continue doing this specific work that was being done. But I also want to have a special case, if it allows, to investigate immediately. Because if individuals say, I have given this intermediary a responsibility to invest my money, I was not aware that my money has been invested improperly or it has been illegally taken. It actually suggests that the beneficial owner distances him or herself from the activities of the intermediary. So I know it's a traditional way, young women, to look at all these intermediaries and their roles, but as a test case, to look at what Oxfam has been saying and what I have been saying, it will give us a strong case for us to be certain way without taking you away from your day-to-day work. All the staff and other institutions in terms of the work that you do. Because out of these 11.5 million documents that have been looked, of course they've been looked, by quite a lot of space for making things. We can only look at those that bring salary and companies issues in the Panama Papers and use that as God. I don't want to take the apples of the English. Wanting to look at the specific company. I want to look at how big is the problem of English flow. How big is the problem of tech avoiding and how can we relate to this company in a way that we can show that because the transparency and information sharing all over the world, the space is getting thinner for them to move in tech savings. Because we shouldn't just make investigations that are going to be so clever and not be open. But she tried to bring back home what South Africa is entitled to and to make individuals aware that actually the space is getting thinner because there's an element in terms of the agreement was signed, the tax agreement was signed with other countries. There will be a lot of information sharing and there will be a lot of transparency and there won't be banks that are in secret jurisdictions that will continue to operate in the manner in which they've been operating in the past. So I think, Mr. Chair, I want to support the bank. Thank you.
No, thank you very much, sir. No, I just want also to join members that are welcoming this report. They are very important and they're taking us somewhere. I would like us to begin with a presentation from the financial intelligence. And in the last page of slide 20, there are results and challenges that they are putting in front of this committee, on which I would like us to, as panelists, to consider. One, they are giving us some statistics, very interesting statistics. They are saying the illicit flows count into transfer pricing or mispricing is 65%. Account for 65%. Secondly, they say criminal activities account for 30%. Corruption and other is 5%, which personally account for guitars and so forth that people are raising. Yes. I'm not saying that we must not deal with that. Now, it goes straight to the point that Honorable Burundi is raising, the demographic representation of the mispricing, misinvoicing. Who are those people in South Africa? Who are they? When did they begin to do this? And how much did they take out of the country illegal and not accounted? Who are these people? So it's fundamental that we get that demographic representation and accountability and to square and lay the ground for debate on this matter. That is the first thing. That is very important. Second, in doing so, if the Republic of South Africa is serious about this matter, because this matter hits the heart of the developmental agenda of the state and the country, we have three deep-seated triplets in quality, unemployment, and poverty. And if there are these issues, that necessarily means others that are opposing the ruling party, they are benefiting from this. For always criticizing the ruling party for its incapacity and lack of resources to make sure that we deliver to our people because of people who are taking out money from South Africa. You know, it's disturbing me, it's encouraging on that. So.
Is it what? He was mainly on the media here, you made your statement, he's covered. You can even leave, I don't think he's interested in the answer. So, you know, I think his point has been made. He's got nothing more to do now. The same thing is repeated every meeting. I think media's captured, they love you, so they've captured you well, I'm sure you'll be leading the story. You repeat a question, ask the House, the minister tells you it's not legal to give a name. You repeat the question here, and the committee chair, we don't have the right to just, you know, preclude you from asking the same question over and over again. And they will repeat the same answer over and over again. But Mr. Jenkins, you will drive the chair, right? We abide by the rules. Now, to be fair to Mr. Rainier, many of us in the ANC also banter and intercede, Makoti. So we have to allow him to do that. But in his case, of course, he's covered now. He's happy.
media is here, they will cover him, he will go to sleep well tonight, he will bring his form, the DA will promote him, you know, he's struggling to get some leadership position there, and we understand. So let's move on. He's got the right to banter and heggle. I mean, Tandy said that only over 2 years, and quite frankly, I have been harassed by Tandy more than anybody else, so quite frankly, and I still love Tandy. I like being harassed, actually. It's less boring. I don't think you have such fun in your committee. The person that gives me the hardest time is Wantandi Tobias Mokola. And she set a standard for the whole of this parliament, including this committee. So he's fine. But again, you're an activist, right? There's a little drip of water of a duck back. Is that an expression? I don't know what it sounds right. Go ahead, right? I mean, you can deal with it. If you don't know the apartheid security police, you can deal with Mr. Mania. He's a little... go ahead.
Well, maybe Jefferson is slightly, because I'm taking space for dancing in Parliament.
Yeah.
So
maybe
Shela, that's...
You're a competitor.
Yeah, but the issue that I'm raising is that if we're serious in the Republic of South Africa to deal with this matter, it should be take seriousness at the aggregation level. We can talk about the collaboration of the department and so forth on this particular matter, but what I want to propose is a collaboration in the executive, where the executive will end up with a subcommittee that deals with this particular matter. And that subcommittee of cabinet should give a mandate to foster all those specific departments to deal with this matter. Because if that there's no mandate from the executive, it's going to be difficult for this collaboration that we're proposing. So I'm proposing that process, which is can replicate into Parliament. We have begun this process, And we have worked so well since 2014 to deal with this matter. So we are on top of it. But it must also go to the executive. That's fundamental that I want to ask. In my recent reading, is that the world is moving very fast in terms of technological advancement on this matter. Where are we in South Africa? If you read the new writings about customs, about tech nations, and other things in the world, they are very far. Where are we? Do we have capabilities to track this? Do we have a software that talks to what Honorable Tani is raising, of tracking quality information that cannot be contested? That this belongs to whom, how much this person, they started in 1970 and they examined. So those are the issues that I want to raise. Because one thing, and we went there to the scanners, we went to the scanners in Devon. One big scanner, other trucks, they are moving out. One big, just one truck, they're not there, they're out. Now, how do you say, do you say that the money and resources that we can use to buy technology that can help us can be more than the money that is going out of South Africa? If that is not the case, why don't we invest? Why don't we invest to customs? Why don't we invest to sales? Why don't we buy those skills that are living, I mean, the public sector? So if we are serious about fighting this matter, we must put money in this matter. So I just wanted to propose this. Thank you very much.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not unknown for making tongue-in-cheek remarks, but I shall desist from responding to the comments from my colleagues and stick to business. A great deal has been said about the catching and finding these illegal activities. And obviously that's an international trend and we have to participate and do that. But I was curious about Michelle's comment about the research. And why I'm curious is, I'm curious to know how much work is being done by us and internationally to prevent these kind of illicit transactions happening. Now, for instance, if you intend on terrorism, well, it's really not going to be easy to stop these transactions having to finance them. However, if you are trying to minimize your tax burden, perhaps there is something that could be done to ensure that my tax burden is somewhat equal, and I'm very much not in for it. I'm sure that the chair would, the finance chair would want to see equality in from his position, but I'm a capitalist through and through. But what I'm saying is that the incentives for these things, how much are we working at trying to look at those and put in place measures that might reduce the need for us to be looking at the wrongdoing and catching the criminals? Because all these things cost a huge amount of money. I'm sure that the FIC operation, among many others, even within SARS, department of 25 people now looking at this. It is burden on the economy. It's not productive in terms of growing the economy. It's necessary. I'm not arguing that it's not necessary at the moment, but surely our emphasis should be on trying to minimize it. And I'm wondering how much research, I mean, the FIC has done some research, and it's been done both here and internationally. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I see our colleague, our Honourable Mbongi, has already covered the SARS issue because we concluded that they definitely had insufficient capacity to deal with the magnitude of the problem. The other area, though, is the, which National Treasury pointed out, Mr. Mamonia, that he spoke about 15 different cases under BEPS broadly, and were quite specific and said transfer pricing, there are four such actions. They are directly identifiable and much easier to address than some of the other aspects in BEPS. And I see no reason, Chairperson, why we can't tackle what we can immediately put measures in place under what we know is there and where it is. And I remember when we had the colloquium and transfer pricing and trade and industry, Judge Dennis Davies spoke about at least $1.1 billion that had been recouped after investigations in 2012 related to transfer pricing, at least. Now what we'd like to get is an annual report as to what we are recouping here and what the outstanding amount is. I don't agree that an estimate is useless. I think an educated, researched estimate is highly valuable, with a statistical, you know, impairment on either side. Now that's what we want. We know it's hundreds of billions. But we believe that if we can just tackle the 20 billion here in South Africa and make a start with 10 billion annually, the cases are right there on the radar screen. We just need the radar to see them. It's like watching a plane come in. Now, the other issue is on the application. Some of our legislation, Chairperson, cannot be effectively implemented, such as broad-based black economic empowerment, as a result of the impairment of transfer pricing, which places negative figures on the balance sheet and that kind of thing, and directly impacts with the socio-economic development in South Africa itself. Let me say, the last issue, I am finding it a little bit difficult to understand how we were one of culprits rather than victims in the trading industry, but we must, of course, look at that ourselves and just see where we had failed the country so that we could do extra oversight. The last point I would like to make is that this impacts negatively on industrialization, and we would like the staff that has got a handle on the exchange control, or that's what I understand, needs to link that up, because it is on the exchange control that a lot of the transfer pricing is occurring here, and this was brought up by several of the institutions you've got here. I was looking for yours, but it's here. You said exchange control violations. I just want to say that we cigarettes are concerned. We're well aware of the illegalities there. What you may not be aware of is that some of these illegal cigarettes are produced right here by legal factories. So it's a very difficult one to address that one. But I want to thank the Chair for opening this up to all of us. Thank you.
Thank you.
I know that you did a little background stuff and you raised some questions. Are there questions that you raised in your documents that have not been addressed yet? And if so, can you just raise them quickly? I know you're new to Parliament and maybe you're feeling a bit shy, and if you don't want to speak, it's okay. But Jumasani Yanzi from PBU.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I think we did the questions with them together. I think probably the question, some of the questions are tried, Chair, but we have not been able to look at the presentation before, so sorry now, I've been trying to go through them. But I think the main question that has always been there is quantifying the loss, because it might as well be that the government's wasting money in investing so many things. It isn't clear what they're chasing. I think that's the bigger question, which for me, it always is going to come out to say, what are they doing? If the government is spending so much on investing and trying to deal with all these things, what are they chasing? I think quite an important question. I think many other members have raised it up there. And I think also the issue of corporations, I think there's quite a lot of information coming out that there's a lot of corporations and institutions, but I think you've got to have corporations with an outcome to at the end of the day what you want to achieve and so on. Because my main challenge, just quickly going through it, that there's quite a lot of reporting coming out saying this is what you've achieved, but based on what? Right? I think that's a bigger question, which I think, as one member say, we need educated research that gives that context. Like I say, might as well be the government is worth money. Thank you. And we will look at the response and in the report with Antonio, we will do some of the following up questions. Thank you.
I want to ask a lot because there's a lot covered already in the question. Really quickly, I think one of the themes that we mentioned or something there is that I think vendors understand that these issues would invariably lack a level of certainty, right? I think even the international institutions, the global integrity structure and so on, are constantly looking at these issues anew. But what I think we're saying is, obviously you will refine and improve your understanding of the issues. But in the meanwhile, you have to exercise it. And that's what people have said. And I think that many members are picking up more and more, this is unusual for somebody of your considerable skill and sensitivity. The way you opened up, I think, is slightly at variance. It doesn't create, you see, that's going to come at the end. But I think we understand that you were trying to tell us, hey, this thing is far more complex, which we know. The question being put to you is, do you agree that while you're working these things out, we have to act decisively? The second issue that arises for me at least, and I think it came across in one of the members, is what is being done? I'm not sure that I understand correctly. It goes to the Financial Intelligence Center, and then presumably the FIC refers matters for action to the SAPS. So the first question is, do all of the allegations made that the FIC has processed to the SAPS go to the SAPS in general, or do they go to organized crime, the hawks that puts it, or what? And then what happens? Does the FIC follow up and say, hey guys, we gave you this case yesterday, we expect by the end of the year, another 6 months, we'll come back. But this case we gave you 2 years ago. What has happened? So in other words, what I'm asking members is, isn't there something missing here? Shouldn't we also call in consultation with the chairperson of police, bring in the NCP, and maybe the NDDP, I'm not sure, to justice, and ask, okay, we can do all this wonderful work. I think what the members are asking is, where's the evidence that is being acted on? In other words, can you give us figures? You see, what we're going to help us, Jumasani and Antonio, that's our job. You are researchers. You are intellectuals. You're like us. We are just big talkers, right? So, what we want from you is guidance, right? I'm thinking of us, the ANC. We are modest enough to know that there are some things that are handled technically. You're brilliant people, right? You're technocrats. You know, the conceit you have, you can teach yourself. Right now, I'm thinking about meaning the people that really matter. Now, the thing is, we don't claim to be experts, right? We're asking for advice from Parliament side to assist in this, right? Can we develop a program? The next time we come here, we ask the things that really matter. Not that's going to be to the media and talk good and speak English. The issue is, how many people have been convicted? How many people, we can't get names obviously, how many people did you forward to the police authorities in the last, let's say, 2 years?
and how many of them have been acted on. So what kind of things about members, let's get some guidance from the members, bring in the security or criminal justice apparatus, yeah, and their committees, and say, hey, what's going on? The other thing I want to ask you, I'm slightly not sure, in the one document, it's the 81 South African entities, and in the other, that's the one from TARS, I think the first one's from the FIT, maybe, or is it the bank, I can't recall, the other comes from TARS. Because we have 1,700 South Africans being mentioned, right? So, are these figures referring to something slightly different? Is the 1,700 or thereabouts referring to what emerged from the Panama Papers? If that's the case, if it's so many people, presumably some of them are not doing anything illegal. All of them presumably are not committing a crime, right? But the question I want to ask is, these Panama Papers, I heard Mr. Mania say, saw it in Eat more recently. What's happening? How will you get more information? From what I read, and maybe I'm out of date, they're going to read it in tranches, right? So at the moment you've got some information, and as things evolve, you'll get more information and so on. So what I'm asking is that correct that you still don't have enough information? It's available out there through the leaks, but it's not made available to the public as such. Is that correct? Then, I'll forego the other questions. Really, the question I will ask you is, what do you think Parliament can do to contribute towards your fulfilling your role more effectively? Beyond calling you here once every 6 months or 3 months, what do you think we as MPs can do?
Okay. Thank you, Chair. I think certainly, I think once we clear, the issue of illicit flows is a high priority for government, certainly for the Treasury. Certainly agree that we need to act decisively now. You don't have to wait for all the information. You know, it's like HIV AIDS. We did need to know that whether the figure was 500,000, 1,000,000, or 1.5. Once it was there, you act. And I think that in acting, Chair, what we say is that the only way to know that we act, because we in the Treasury we sit in our ivory tower, I sit on a 22nd floor. It's our colleagues here who are in the front line who will actually have the actual info. And so I think you've seen from them what each of them is doing. Now, are they doing enough? Should it be more? I'm only seeing a third of the problem, two-thirds, who knows? We don't need to know the answer to kind of say they should be doing more. If customs is there, are they inspecting every plane or at what point, etc.? Are you looking at the border with Lesotho? I'm just looking at what's out in newspapers, okay? And I'm going to refer to that. I think the public needs to have confidence that when cases are reported, somebody is following through. The difficulty they have is that there is limitation sometimes in the law that they cannot talk about one case. Specifically, they may not. Let them answer the specific questions. And I think, as you said, the minister outlined, if it's info from the FIC, it doesn't even get to the minister. So we don't have the minister or the treasurer. Even the FIC has limitations to whom he can provide that info. He cannot come here, and it's not obfuscating share. But in terms of the law, they have efforts in the law. And I'm sure nobody's suggesting they go beyond the law. Having said that, one understands in the public interest where there are cases, we all want to know that somebody is acting. So certainly, Honourable Mokose, it is a priority, and I don't want you to get the impression that it's not. But let me also say this, and I think South Africa is doing a lot. It may well be an EU priority, but is every country then doing something about it? And what I'm saying is a lot of this requires lots of agencies to be working, lots of capacity, not just number of scanners, intellectual research capacity, intelligence. And let me add, because in truth of powers, if you look at cigarette smuggling, the way I understand it, when, for example, in SARS, that was always the focus. And all the stuff in the news, the way I understand it, again, I'm not involved in that, but was around cigarette smuggling, because these syndicates are extremely sophisticated. They are maybe 5 steps ahead of us. So unless we have that capability, we're always going to be behind the curve. And so it's not just a matter, under a member, of just getting the physical resources. It's a matter of also getting the architecture right. And if SAR has no intrusive capacity, a lot of people will use that not to pay their taxes. And the intrusive capacity you need is that they should be able to go in and find information. They should be able to then ensure the charges are laid, aside from the administrative powers that SAR enjoys. So there are issues there, and what I tried to bring up, Chair, to say back to you, is just some of the complexities. Because for me the question is, how are we doing now? Then there are other issues. So let's take Panama. I think you asked what's been done in Panama. And I think the first thing saying is, we didn't say what all these agencies are doing. I don't know, in government there are other agencies. Should they not also be doing something? Don't place all the burden on the Treasury. Where are the other entities here today reporting? I hope they will report what they do. To the extent that we report, I guess what we want to say is, even if there are limitations, there's no place to hide. Today it's Panama, tomorrow it might be Dubai, tomorrow it might be another tax haven, okay? The info will come out. That's why we want people to grant their affairs. We've got the threshold GDP. Because the problem we face is, once anything is outside the country, it's very hard to take legal action because it's not under our control. We have to rely on treaties or agreements and all kinds of international agreements. But in Panama, like and you know, Yanga there went there for 10 days after, no, a week. And I warned her about Zika when she went there. But, you know, Panama decided that they are not going to be part of the automatic exchange of information. Neither do we have, and that's why this leak is important. And secondly, that they also do not have any treaty with us. Okay. So we're not going to get that info. Just reading newspapers, the one tax authority that has got more than the data that they put out on the website, and that's a lot of info, but the underlying documentation has not been put out. Now, someone like the Canadian tax authorities have somehow got the more detailed info according to news reports. It seems we don't, okay? Now, SARS and so on can try and use other ways of trying to get that info in terms of their regulatory framework. But, so we just try to say, these things are not, the names are there, people can act. They are doing, as the authorities, as much, I believe, that they're able to do, but they still have limited information. So, and of course, let's make the point. You don't want the tax system or FIC to be operating selectively, not going for X or Y, or only going for X or Y. They must go for anyone who's breaking the law. And that's the approach that one sort of takes in these matters. I think, Chair, when it comes to issues, and I don't know why we've asked about, you know, I thought the days of, you know, no non-whites can use the rule is over. I personally resent the term non-white. I don't think anybody is a non-person. But, you know, we can give breakdowns and let's see what breakdowns need to be made. So certainly, I think what he's saying is, and what I want to appeal to members is, let's also not put it like the info is certain. You know, reading an article in a newspaper is not enough evidence. Yet it alerts people, and hopefully they can investigate. We still need, they need, I mean, sorry, they still need harder information before, presumably, they can act. But let them say so. Let them say, you know, what they can do and what they can't do. And, Chair, I would agree with the proposal. I do think that the pressure from this this meeting helps, because, you know, perhaps it does need to be stepped up as a government-wide coordination exercise. Because perhaps, you know, what I was trying to say is the prosecuting authorities act when they do. It's not clear to me whether they act on everything that the FIC may have given them. They may or may not have. Similarly, the FIC may not have acted on all the information that's available in newspapers. Again, how do you know that? And this is what we wanted to do here, is to come and account. And to the extent that you can help us get a broad program, I think, government-wide is important. And certainly, the issue is the estimates are important. They give you a sense for the field. But the methodologies are very promising. And I do think some of the numbers, whether the scale is too high or too low, we do need to assess that, because then we can sharpen the action that we need to take. If you rely on the numbers which are based on statistical numbers, on trade data, it doesn't have names. It doesn't say what. Now, the only way to do it is, yes, you get William here, and he will say, now, customs, are you sleeping on the job? How many containers do you check when they leave? Okay. Those scanners, what do they show you? Okay. I mean, I was asking at a story. They got somebody with 23 kilograms of gold. But you know what? That wasn't an outflow. That was an inflow. Okay. Somebody was coming from one of our neighboring countries or somewhere, bringing it illegally into South Africa. Okay. And they caught that person. Now, how many people have they not caught? Because if these are random, or by percentage, or by profiling, they're going to get some people. They're not going to get all. But yeah, let us quickly answer, I think, the questions that are there. And I want to say that I also want Nishana to answer, because I only learned that she said she came last year, but this is going to be her last presence here, so you can ask her why it's her last presentation here. I hope it's not her last, but will you?
Thank you, Jefferson. I will attempt to answer those questions that are related to customs operations. There was a question about, I'm not sure if I attempt to answer that, about the exit of the Gupta. We received a general declaration from the Captain of the Fly on that particular day when the plane left. And what was declared and what we checked and confirmed was 8 passengers, 8 crew members, and 15 fares. And all that luggage was presented to customs, scanned and checked, and we didn't find anything untoward. That was one. And then the issue of the China malls and life, we do make follow-ups in this regard. We might not have done raids that are updating the media and things like this. However, what we do is we take data coming in, we take it through what we call a risk process, and through that risk management, determine whether the goods are allowed into the country or not. For those that might have missed that particular time, we have another process that supplements them, that is called post-clearance audit. So for those goods that we might not have checked at the border, we go to where they're supposed to have landed, and we follow up there. And if there's any untoward behavior in that regard, there's a case that is raised, and we from a past perspective, we deal with it from a criminal point of view. And those, they might not appear in the court, because it might be a much more of an administrative penalty that we would have issued, and therefore it don't appear in the court or the media or anything of that sort. So it would be a settlement in part than the particular trader or agent. So that's how we deal with some of these issues. As I'm saying, we might not have necessarily raided the malls and the like. Where we have raided them, we might not have invited the media or anything of that sort. In terms of scanning of the goods, well, scanned for a certain or a particular percentage or something like that, I think my previous answer touched to some extent on this question that we work on a risk management basis. We require the traders and the agents to supply us with information about 24 to 48 hours before the goods arrive into the country. With that information, as I said, we perform risk management on those goods. And based on the risk that we would have identified, we would therefore scan whatever that we want to scan. And members will tell me, you were to scan 100%, each and every truck or container that comes into the country, and if you were to take Durban as big as it is, would actually clog up the traffic. Most of the manufacturers today work on just in time process. Yeah, so they don't pour capital goods, that was a waste of money for it. So the part that comes through, take BMW for instance. So at that particular time when they require a particular part, it would have arrived into the country and it would have moved over to Auckland for it to be part of that BMW that one of the members of the purchase plantation. So work therefore on risk management basis. So up front we would have given BMW a particular status because we know their controls and we understand who BMW is. So they're good because they're not used to us. And we know that we comply with the same upfront. And we have launched a program called Preferred Trader. So those type of goods would not subject them to strict inspection as much. So they would move through therefore and not necessarily be scanned 100%. And by the way, the things that we have put in place, it also includes the sealing of the container that we have come through. We understand, you know, the numbers from BMW, what fuel they put on, and what type of fuel they put on. And therefore, if that fuel is in place, and we know that number, that those can actually go through without being checked or being scanned. So there is not necessarily all the time a need for us to scan each and every electrical container that comes into the country. We work on a risk management basis, members. And we've got systems. The question was asked about our systems and IT systems that actually assist us in doing this. So the information that will have come through automatically from the traders and from the agents would have gone into the system to check against certain data that we have got, against certain rules, risk rules that we have included into the risk engine itself. And it will spew out results that would say, stop that container because we don't understand what it is in there. Or because of the risk that would have identified through the risk engine. Therefore, we stop it, inspect it, scan it, tailgate it, and unpack or do anything that we want to do from a customs law implementation point of view. I think that was. Oh, yes, the checking of goods from coming from, say, Devon going to Malawi, as an example was made. Our system tells us so if or when a container arrives in Durban, then it's destined for Malawi. Because of the upfront information that we would have received, we know exactly about that. So as it lands in Durban, the message that goes to the trader is to say, you can proceed for the system. If we are happy with those goods, although we have managed it, we would send a message to the trader to say, you can proceed to the border. The border being of exit border. Should it not hit that border at a particular time, and every little time, and we don't receive a critical document or a critical information that the goods have left the country, we then would do a follow up on a particular good. And we've got a team of people that deals with exactly that. As I said, we've got a post clearance audit process. We also have a technical intervention unit for goods that are headed and back into the country. We follow up on those. And actually, as I said, deal with them from a criminal point of view. If they choose to back it and give us the necessary penalties that would have raised, they would do that. If they dispute that, would therefore have to go to court and things like that. And that's when some of these issues will come up into the media. But don't always come into the media or into the public, because most of the traders would rather prefer to settle them with us. Thank you, sir.
Some guidance. Are people prepared to stay beyond 1 o'clock? How many? 1, 2, 3. All right, let's try to finish by 1. So you've got to run up in the last 5 minutes. You've got 20 minutes. A couple of colleagues begin to follow up in August, September, in a more structured setting. Yeah.
Chairperson, if I may just make one comment, I think it's important that it's put on record. I just want to contextualize what William said earlier on. The example that he gave about a particular text being BMW, he just mentioned an example. You need to place it on the court. It should not be a level of contact before, seeing that there's the members of the media as well. Yes. So I'm just simply saying that I think it's important that we understand that the example that we have made about a particular text in BMW is just is an example. There is case selection and governance, that case selection and execution governance that regulate whatever that we do in the organization. So I just wanted to place that on the record. Thank you. May I just also address one quick issue? The issue about the categorization of the list based on the races for net, on race, we are unable to provide that information at the moment. We can make that information available after we've completed all the analysis. I'm sure Momo as well uses information that we can also share with us. So I think it can be part of our pretend responses to this particular house so we can do the record.
We publish that before we meet again. Outstanding issues, if you can. Antonio and Musani will help. And when this guy is the one, yes.
Yes, from the South African resident point of view.
Okay.
Saying, Honorable Chairperson, that from the South African resident point of view, in terms of the Panama Papers information, we are dealing with that information. I hear the Honorable Member said, we seem not to be doing much in that regard, but you must take into account that when that information came, the hotels voted. We've got our work of prevention that we are responsible for. That is a recovery process that will take some time, and we'll be able to tell when we come next year as to what we did with that information. But we've got current work, limited resources, that we are focusing on prevention. With that information, we'll give residents that we are completing to the court, but that's the same. And then we'll be able to pick up and then put the possibilities of people that are already been authorized through the previous processes of amnesty and VDP in the process. But we'll be able to tell once we have sifted through all that information. And the other honorable member asked in terms of the cross-border information whether we can be able to see the information in terms of if it flows or illegal whatsoever. It becomes very difficult because we monitor the information. And then sometimes we have to send inspectors. There are areas where we have identified in South Africa where some of the organized dealers have got deep controls, and you find that people take advantage of that area to take money out of the South country. And when we monitor the system, we can send inspectors there to say, what makes such a spike and an unusual phenomenon that this area being so small, a lot of funds are getting out of the country from that particular area. So we do monitor that information. But information that comes through the system is not all legal. If I can make an example, if you look at illegal online gambling, people, if they play on offside sites with their credit card, we capture that information and we follow it up together with the National Gambling Board because they are not allowed to play. So not all information that is on the system is legal. The problem is that we can actually monitor it, it's quite vital that we can be able to see through and then see what is illegal. Sometimes an after effect, having done some infections, just to get verification of that information. Thanks, Chairperson.
Okay,
music.
There were a couple of comments made, but two direct questions, and in fact, I'm going to try and link the two questions together. The first one was in relation to how do we test that entities, individuals are legal or not if they are operating within the financial system. And the second one has to do with essentially customer due diligence process preventive issues within the financial institutions. We must see this as a process here. The first one would be that it's the financial institutions or the bank's responsibility to identify their customers. They need to know who they're working with as individuals or as entities. As individuals, their reference point would be the Home Affairs National Population Registry. As entities, it would be the CIPC, the company, the Intellectual Property Commission. Those are the only two entities which provide the legal basis for whom they are doing business with. Obviously, once those institutions, if they detect that there is something untoward that has happened, they would provide the FIC with information. Our first port of call would be to go back to either the population registry or to the CIPC to check whether those companies or whatever are real or not. So that's our first process of verification. We have to say, however, that, for example, if foreign nationals set up a company in a country, we wouldn't necessarily know that, neither would CIPC know that. They wouldn't have the information about that individual or group of individuals if they are from outside the country. So, already there's a smokescreen can be created. Chair, the committee passed an amendment to the FIC legislation. You introduced two things here. The first was the beneficial ownership, which is a critically important thing, because what it will do, it will begin to deal with the natural owners behind entities and so on, and do away with the smokescreen of front company, shell companies and so on. We'll be able to pierce that and get behind that. We'll be able to bring together, over time, individuals, the natural person behind companies, behind trusts, behind property deals, behind shareholdings and so on. That's a piece of work that we're going to have to work on, and we'll obviously be reporting to you in the committee. The second one, and it goes to the Honourable Heather's question, is a risk-based approach, which then enables the financial institutions to determine the extent of the risk involved, either an entity or an individual, categorize that risk, and then do the necessary due diligence or not. So I hope I've covered both of those in answering the question, Chair. Thank you.
Who else? Yeah, I had a question that he asked on behalf of Parliament, though he had no mandate. Why are you going, if I may ask?
So I'm not at liberty to say. And instructions not to comment. Thank you.
Comment. We say that, look, you know, you're very young, you're a woman, you're black in the sense of being sort of color. That adds to our views that people like you, who you appeared for our political, for the committee, is really impressed with you. Like that, they actually said, remember, I think it was you who didn't speak until the last minute. Was it you? And then we said, why didn't you speak more? Or was it the other one? Okay, fine. What I'm saying is that, well, Parliament, we're not Parliament, the majority in this committee, let's be clear, so we get drawn in this domain into these things. You've got to be keeping. The majority in the committee will regret that somebody of your caliber and your background is leaving, and you're very young. If you go, it's like a big pool out there. So I hope that whatever reason you do it, you're leaving for, it's something that if you were to share with us, we would understand. I hope it's nothing else, because in the public service, there's so much politics at the moment, and so much of internal infighting, also got nothing to deal with it. So wish you well wherever you went. So we can express a point of view, we've got the majority. Is there anything that I think you don't agree majority? No, good, fine. Let's go on. Mr.
I think we answered all
my fine. So we've got about 10 minutes left before the chair is putting to a close. Remember, we agreed to meet with you early in the next quarter. But now it's been a bit complex because we're thinking, as I agree, as I understand, to bring in the Police Committee and maybe even the Justice Committee. See, getting these committees would be hard, but let's see. So you want to say something, Mr. Mayor?
Chair, I thought the question that you asked about whether there was an attempt or a process underway to get access to the larger body of data, which you mentioned at least one tax authority, if I recall correctly, Canada already had possession of, whether that process is underway. I thought that was a good question, but it wasn't the budget.
That is saying that if Canada can do it, you're right, Mr. Mayor, for one. Canada can do it, why can't we?
In the newspaper, but Flop can answer it.
No, Chair, we actually asked the Canadian commissioner when we saw him 2 weeks ago in Moscow. We asked him, do you have the information? He said, no, he does not have the information. No one, we are not aware of anyone that has the information. There are the entity which I mentioned earlier called JESTIC, which is that international body of tax administrators. They are doing a lot of work to try to get the data out that would not be successful.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, David. I'm no longer close with you. You've asked something relevant, at least for one. Chair, I just wondered, probably, in the State Department, notwithstanding the confidentiality issues and sensitivity of the information, one of the things that I don't think we are doing enough is communicating when things are happening. I'm talking about SARS in particular. Because some of the cases, they don't necessarily go to, they don't necessarily have to go through the legal process. But where there is something that is made, that is happening, that has been able to become, that has been able to issue a fine or something like that, what is your media strategy in terms of that? Do you actually publicize that? Because to me, I think we can use media to our advantage. I mean, Panama Papers, irrespective of where they come from or whatever, to me, I think they have really played a major role in actually, you know, I mean, some of the business people that, you know, in South Africa mentioned and so forth and so on. Now, somehow, they also went into the space of prevention, you know? So I just want to find out from fans, big, probably not the reserve, but especially SARS and big, because that is actually very important. I don't actually get a sense that we use the media enough to our advantage.
excuse me, can you reply? Is that it? Mr.
Chairman, thank you to Mr. Michel for his answer to my question, and I accept that the risk-based approach is an improvement, it's great. But just to take the Panama example then, to illustrate where I was very poorly wording and trying to go, you know, if Panama were involved in developing a nuclear bomb, there would be international pressure on Panama, there would be sanctions and all sorts. And yet, in a financial nuclear bomb, no one really wants to cooperate. I mean, that's not true. I don't know with what cooperation has taken place. Let me withdraw that remark. So I was wondering whether there was kind of moves afoot to actually say to guys, if you don't toe the line, if you don't sign these agreements and treaties, well, then you're out in the cold, and we're not going to deal with you. And I think MoMA has threatened us with that if we don't pass. Get the back that thing going, you know, listen out to you, or...
You must, it's a pity your colleague can't bring himself to ask questions like that, apart from repeating the same thing over and over again. Frank Jenkins, is there any rule that a chair can say, we are now bored? Or is there any rule that a chair can instruct the media to cover Mr. Mayor's point? Once the thing is covered in the media, give an interview then. Just leave after this question. Are Gupta's being pursued by the AIT? It's been told by Minister Finance, Gordon, it can't be answered. The AIT says it can't be answered. So can you cover that, erase that, and then it will relieve us of that. But can I make a point, by the way, before we get on? I want to make a point, Makoni. You see, let people misunderstand. All of us in this committee, presumably, all of us, if the Guptas have done something wrong, they must be pursued. None of us here, in their right minds, will want them to escape responsibility. And will expect any other person committing offences to be treated similarly to any allegations that are made about the Gupta. We don't know. All of us have our own views about this matter. But as far as that's concerned, Mr. Momanya, if the Guptas have done something wrong, act against them in terms of the law. But I do think, you know what, we should be consistent. When people approach the banks and ask the banks, why have you closed off all their accounts, and the bank says, we cannot reveal to you, it's a client confidentiality issue, the laws and the norms, the laws of this parliament and other international institutions and parliaments pass, preclude us from doing so. A certain party won't raise that, a certain individual won't raise that as an issue. But when the Financial Intelligence Center and Minister Gordhan say the law doesn't, the very law that this committee passed and this parliament has passed, we say answer the question. So we can't pass laws and then expect entities not to abide by those laws. Let us get law. So I really feel, Mr. Benny, I'm appealing to you. Your question has been asked on many forums. Release another press statement. I would urge journalists, I know some of you, right, my friend there, right, please, then just write up a story. Give him an interview now. Let's get that one done with. Because we're not going to have this question again. I'm going to ask you a question to guide me on this. And you've heard it so many times, in the house even, right? about it. I'm going to rule this question out now. And the media are going to get bored, David. They need to find something else to ask. Right. So having said that, can we be clear? We wanted to act against the Buddha and everybody was being wrong. If the Buddha was being wrong, deal with them. In terms of the many laws this Parliament's passed. Now, Joan is very shy. I don't know why she asked me to read her question. Please ask your question yourself. Thank you.
Whatever language? In English. Thank you, Chair. We have repeatedly asked for the transfer pricing information. And I read this morning that we have been told there has been a recovery of certain funds in 2012. And I would imagine if you did it in 2012 using that law, you're still able to do it on an annual basis. Please, will you communicate those details to trade and industry? Please. And the names of the culprits. Thanks.
Please. Quick reply. We're ending now. Anybody, 3 minutes, please.
Okay. With regard to the international pressure on Panama, we are on the global stand for exchange of information. I was the assessor of Panama on exchange of information. We went to Panama, we reviewed Panama. So the report is going to be discussed at the global forum in September. But they said to us that they do not want automatic exchange of information in the country because it's sovereign right to refuse to enter into automatic exchange of information. And we've been wanting to negotiate an exchange of information with Panama, which is bilateral, but Panama is refused. So we are asking Panama to do something.
It's really good what you're saying. Can we pick that up, actually? It might take 20 years for government to act. We will acknowledge it as our police contribution to dealing with this. Okay. Please, John.
Jefferson, the...
I just what when you say, you know, Treasury doesn't act against anybody. Okay? Yeah. Whatever. Yeah.
All right. Are we done? Just quickly summarize.
Oh, sorry, quickly. I wanted to comment to the Honorable Mokosi's question around the communication strategy in terms of, put it loosely, why not rename chain? It's because of the legislation that you put in this Parliament that talks to the secrecy provision that we need to protect the information, the confidentiality of the text there. So we can't go out and say, if we do that, it will be on an anonymous basis. We cannot mention the taxpayer's name.
Can I also hear from the Reserve Bank when you comment on this matter that those institutions or individuals, illegal funds that have been forfeited to state, we published them in the government gazette. So recently we had a press interest because we had a huge blockage of 34 million that was forfeited to state. Because of the magnitude, there was so much interest, but the names and details are there for everybody to see.
Okay, thanks. So I'm correct in the quick summary. One is that we want to meet again. Now, we're going to bring all the committees together, right? We'll confer amongst ourselves and see when we can do it. We want to do it reasonably soon when we come back. But on the other hand, can I suggest, let's not call them just for the sake of a mechanical follow-up meeting. Let's confer with them and see where the Panama Papers process is on. So why don't we agree that sometime before the end of the third quarter, these three committees, justice and police at least, five, and then we will try to get the others, but let's not be too ambitious. We will get Antonio and Vasani to help to draft a paper that we will distribute to all the members beforehand, a 3-4 page thing that directs the next meeting. Then I think just by bringing them together, we are actually putting them under pressure. So in that sense, Parliament plays some role. We'll never ask what more we could do. We'll like to hear from you concretely the next time, Momo and the team. The other thing to say is that in the first instance for government, for the executive to coordinate more effectively, my sense is, and I could be wrong, that you guys get together now on the eve of coming to Parliament, you'll share information. You'll share information inter-episodically, and I don't know, but is there a structure that brings all of you together, including the NPA and so on? What I suggest we do, the 3 chairs here be mandated by this committee to write to the ministers concerned, right? Let's draft the letter, we'll pass it around within, can you notice where, Olivia? Within 10 days we will write a letter to the ministers concerned to say we would like to see more coordination and we'd like a report on that. We can even ask a question in the House and so on if nothing really happened. And maybe we should look into writing to the head of government business too, to say, you're head of government business. Can you, given the importance of this issue, actually, you know, and then we can ask a question to the head of government business. Nothing prevents on the chair asking, what have you done since Parliament wrote to you, head of government business, to coordinate everybody? Let's look into all these things. These are aspects of a program, Antonio, that you would Putin thinks we are saying now. But writing a letter.
Right.
Now, the other thing that's important is being an industry. We didn't hear from you today. This is an omission, right? So I'm going to give you 1 minute now. But the next time we meet, we'll organize the program better. It'll be a longer sitting and a more effective, productive engagement with you. So I think we're quite fine at 3 hours. We've had quickly, please.
Yes, sir. I'd like to bring to the attention of the committee that since all the attacks last year only started, because we have been able to meet as a task team. Dr. Lewis will say that we have been able to meet where we agree on various actions that we will undertake. But also the industry was well represented, and various agencies, some of them are here. We've been able to meet. We've set up an action center of what to do. I think what is to happen now is to then to listen that in terms of the issue that was talking, so that we are able to then what the policy that was spoken about today, but also the intention that some of the agencies spoke about. Indeed, we did meet a number of times. The last time was early this year. All of us since we gave us
very much. Yeah. But we want the ministers to take political responsibility to the health of our country. And indeed, we will call the ministry at some stage, at least the key one. Also, Antonia and Jovetani, you got 10 days, but up to next Friday. Do the draft, we'll send it to all the members of all the committees, staff, comment in checking, and we get that done. The letter we can send here by next Monday or Tuesday, I'll send you the draft. Okay, we're done. Is there anything else for now? No. You know what worries me about Parliament, Makoti? How he tames people. Can you believe that Fred Luzico sat here for 3 hours? This vibrant, compact, ambulance, former provincial secretary of COSATU that addresses thousands and thousands of workers without a single note and speaks for hours and hours, is so quiet. We are both very intimidated that he said nothing, and we have to give the honor of thanking everybody.
There's something they say after every word of God has been said. We say I'm getting fair. So that's what the current says I must do. The only thing that I think from here as we close is that we need to find synergy on the work that is being done. That's why I keep quiet. Honorable Karen, something they say, ignorance is quite an expensive exercise. So sometimes you learn to listen so that you get updated. But I think to me, I don't think it's an assumption we must make, because the risk is quite high, even when I listen to the Minister of Finance, that we might end up doing work that is being done on the other side. At some point, I think we need to see, get that briefing directly as to whether is there any work that is being done. And probably a possibility, I don't know, honestly, a possibility whether is there a vision or in this phase strengthening of the legislation on this matter, so that we don't go a long distance and then realize that the executive is also doing a particular process on the other side. And that's saying that issue which has to do besides the question of the leader of government. I was going to say probably part of the responsibility of the chairperson is to look on that issue, and if there's any initiative that is being taken, we're then able to make sure that the committee approved. Maybe in that work, we may find and say how to be first time. I think that's the first thing. The second thing I think we have to agree, we'll have again to go back. I don't want to change decisions of a committee, or committees in particular. Look as to whether, sometimes when you create a decision, well, there are two things we should be very careful. Our duty sometimes is policy formulation. We may run the risk of entering other terms. Yes, information is very important when you do policy. We have to go back even on that practical exercise, because you create the decision. Those who are custodians of enforcement of legislation, they have had to develop a particular understanding. So I'm telling that issue bringing in whether it's your, what you call, transunit or your NPA and so forth and so forth, it must be considered in the backdrop of the fact that is it about the legislation or is it about information? Because legislation is to remain a responsibility of that particular area where it, in the Australian active end of a plan. So that's a part of the work of the secretary should not just be to write letters, is to look on how fast we can do a coordinated exercise. Which to me would also say, because this is sometimes there is the information that we have, we'll also have to look at is there a way you're consolidating so that you don't have this one saying I'm doing this, this one saying I'm doing this, to say how this is structured in a way that it is able to talk to one another. But on that score, as I've said, we must thank everyone, including those who were quiet even when I was not here, and say that hopefully we will be able to finalize this exercise, because also I can't sit every day and deal with one aspect. One thing as I know, I must say is that I don't think now there's anyone who can have doubts that this issue no one has been avoiding, because the impression at some point has been created that there are people who are avoiding to deal with this matter. And I think with the extent of work that has been done so far, it is clear that from everyone there is commitment to do so. Thank you very much.
Thank you.